ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
And just like that, we're back and we're getting set for UFC Fight Night, Mackenzie Dern versus Yan Xiaonan, 2 weeks away. Thanks so much for joining us. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, as always, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. Our parents weren't that mean. They didn't add FNP to your last name, but you did to your Twitter and your Instagram, and you can find us over there every single week. And this is the last week, your last opportunity to catch us breaking down Dana White's contender series. It's week number 10. Bo Nichols coming in against Donovan Beard in that main event. And I can't wait for it. That's live on Monday night. The show being Dana White's contender series on Tuesday, as always. So if you haven't checked out any of that content, we're absolutely rolling over there and looking to parlay that forward into this fight night card that is a little bit strange. And listen, I don't like to be, you know, all happy feet. I don't like to pat myself on the back too much, but I think our poster looks a lot better than the you spin me right round, baby right round version that the UFC went with, the Mr. Krabs meme spinning around. But Dern Yan as a main event, a little bit of a head scratcher there. And you only have four ranked fighters on this overall card, but this is a Fight Night Pick special because we're going to get you locked and loaded. There's a lot of prospects. There's a lot of underground kings and some queens to get you ready for this one. In a lot of fights where both fighters desperately need a win, and those are always the ones that end up being the entertaining fights that we all talk about for weeks and months after the fight night happens. And you're right. Is the main event the most important ever? Well, no, it isn't. But still, it is an important fight for the division. 115 does feel like it is a little bit wide open right now. You've got sort of the three queens, if you would. You had Rose. You have Weili and Joanna. Joanna's no longer in the picture, so of course one of these fighters wants to replace themselves in that, and really anybody in the top five is good enough to feel like they could probably get the title at this point, so really important main event. And even in the co-main event, I think Randy Brown versus Francisco Trinaldo, is it the most important fight? Like I said, is this going to determine who the next number one contender is? No, but is this a good fight for Randy Brown to take as he's looking to climb the ranks? Of course it is. Trinaldo's a tough fighter for anybody inside or outside the rankings, so I think there's a lot of fights like those ones that, are they really going to wow you with their star names? Not at all, but the fights themselves should deliver. And for Randy Brown, come a rude boy, boy, can you get it up? For Francisco Trinaldo, his wife probably does have to ask him multiple times in the run of a week, Francisco, can you get it up? And the craziest part about this fight week, Matt, this is 2022. You have fighters born in 1977, 1978, 1979, a throwback to the 70s with Olenek, Trinaldo, and Guido Canetti. I mean, the wheels could fall off on this card.
Olenek made his debut before I was born. That's wild. I'm 23 years old. Like, Alexei Olenek's been doing this thing for a minute now.
Matt, ED medication on point, on fleek for these guys, as they say. We're going to throw it on over to our fight of the night screen. And listen, there are some underground fights. We're going to break them down. Make sure you let us know down below in the comments section who you have. It's time for the fight of the night screen.
Let us know down below in the comments section who you've got. It's time for the fight of the night with Fight Night Picks.
Mike Davis doesn't fight very often, but when he does, it's balls to the wall. And for Florida's Davis, he's going to be taking on Slava Claus, Slava Borshov. This is a striker's paradise. Both of these guys with professional boxing experience, 3-0 for Mike Davis, 2-0 for Slava Borshov. Borshov, though, K1 champ, 2010, 2011. The guy bangs when it's on the feet. So does Mike Davis. He likes to mix it up. But both of these guys, primarily known as strikers, I absolutely love this fight. And if you thought, hey, pop and popcorn, but this is the time that I grab the pop and popcorn, don't do that. You stick around for this fight. It's a great one.
And both these guys have a chance to rekindle a lot of the hype that they once had. Like you said, Mike Davis unfortunately doesn't fight as much as, let's be honest, most fans would like him to, because he is that entertaining. And for Slava Borshev, he had a lot of hype coming into the UFC, lost a little bit when he fought Mark Jacquesi, but if you're able to go out there and beat a guy like Mike Davis, who, yes, has been off for a bit, but I think we all just know how talented he is, it gives him a great chance to get right back to where he was kind of before he made his debut against Dakota Bush. I think this is a great fight for both guys.
Man, absolute banger between those two guys. And the second pick, Sexy Mexi and Daniel Santos, Willy Cat. Now, I'm going to throw it out there. I've got a little bit of an audio drop that you're not going to want to miss right before this video.
But man, these two guys have such fun styles. For Willy Cat coming into the UFC, it was spinning stuff. It was that great high guard when he's walking guys down, really reminiscent of the training partners that he has at Shoot the Box, Diego Lima. But Daniel Santos is all about taking risks. And then in his debut, he didn't look very good against Julio Arce, but it's Julio Arce. It was a really tall task. And when you look at it for Castaneda, lose to Nathaniel Wood in his UFC debut. So what? Who cares? Eddie Wineland knocks him out. Finishes Miles John, knock him out, drag him out type of finish. These two guys are going to put on for as long as it is on, and I think it's going to be a fun fight while it lasts.
This is one of those fights that can be fight of the night, whether it ends in the first round, the second round, or the third round. Both these guys come to fight, and they both come to win in that knockout capacity. Neither guy's worried about eating a shot to give their own. I could see this going any which way. We could see a double knockdown a la Fedor or Matt Mitrione in this matchup. This should be one of those fights where you might not know about either guy going into it, but when it's over, you're definitely going to know about them.
The close alternate of a third, Jaime Barcelos is taking on Trevin Jones, but which version of both guys show up? Does Trevin decide to throw a little bit of volume? I don't know. You let us know down below in the comment section who you have in the fight of the night screen. 13 total fights. You're not wrong till Saturday night. Let us know who you have down below. So dotting I's and crossing T's, three fighters born in the 70s, which doesn't happen very often anymore.
Right now.
It's not 1990, but what I do have to say is Nick Diaz Army, stand up. Chelsea Chandler, 4-1 as a pro, making her UFC debut at a catchweight of 140 pounds, taking on Yulia Stolyarenko. We also have Don Shameless Shanus taking on Sadiq Youssef, your 12th ranked featherweight. But that should be a big fight. I mean, for Shanus, he is a lightweight champ with FAC in Kansas. He's also a featherweight champ with Cage Titans, the Calvin Kattar promotion.
The fight reminds me a little bit of when Josh Emmett fought Ricardo Lamas. Remember, no one knew who Josh Emmett was? He was a guy who had lost to Desmond Green in the lightweight division, and that was all anyone knew him for. Then moves down in weight, gets a short notice opportunity against one of the best fighters in the division. Now we all know who Josh Emmett is. So for Shanus, he has an opportunity to have that kind of an impact on this division. And at 145, it takes fighters years to just crack into the rankings and finally get, you know, people like Sadiq Youssef as an opponent. So Don has probably the biggest opportunity of anybody on this card, if we're all being honest.
Only four ranked contenders on the card. Mackenzie Dern, Yan Xiaonan in that co-main event. You go down through it a little bit, and then we're starting to grasp. Jessica Penne is, of course, ranked, which is kind of a surprise because you'd think some other fighters might leapfrog her. And then you also have Sadiq Youssef, as I mentioned. But a lot of fighters really trying to find their footings. A lot of older fighters. I mean, Max Grecian, Felipe Lins also getting up there. Jocko's been around the UFC for a long time. There is a lot of longevity in this card, but there's a lot of Billy talent, nothing to lose when no one knows your name. And there's a lot of fighters that really need wins here.
Exactly. And that's what I keep on thinking about when I think about this card. Is the star value there? Not necessarily, but it is a deep card with regards to interesting fights that you should care about. The fact that Brennan Allen versus Christoph Jocko is buried on the prelims is kind of disrespectful to both those fighters, because Brennan Allen at one point was one of the hottest prospects in this division. And for Jocko, I get it. He was never really able to break through and become a legitimate top 10 contender, but he was a guy who stuck around in that 15 to 10 range for a while in the UFC. So I'm a little surprised that that fight doesn't find itself on the main card, because I think that's going to be a really fun one.
It is an interesting fight night card. It is a fight night pick special. You toss us a like, we'll keep doing the damn thing. You're not going to want to miss any of these videos. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, California-based grapplers are set to meet up in Vegas as we have Baby Shark, Tabitha Ricci, set to take on the nearly 40-year-old Ultimate Fighter finalist. She had a great fight of the year against Randa Markos in Jessica Penne. And I mean, if you consider it, she was on the Ultimate Fighter season 20. She was a standout over there, wasn't able to get it done all the way up near the top, but she does get a win and then automatically vault herself into a fight against Ioana Jędrzejczyk. And
that did not go well at all.
She had that fight against Jessica Andrade. That fight did not go very well. She fought Danielle Taylor. That fight also did not go very well. And then for a period from 2017 to 2021, Jessica Penne went dark. And we didn't really hear a lot about her. You'd see her doing commentary gigs here and there, but she had USADA complications, injury complications. She steps back into the cage in 2021 and somehow melted my mind and everybody else's, and she beat Lupita Godinez by split decision, which was strange. Then she goes out there and fights Karolina Kovalkiewicz, and it's like, wow,
They both fought near the top of the mountain. I mean, that's going to be an interesting fight, right? Nope. Kovalkiewicz decided that she was going to entertain some of the grappling of Penne. And Penne was able to cinch up a quick submission win in the first round. Look amazing. Performance bonus on that card. And for Penne, that's a win that now all of a sudden, it didn't look all that great in the moment. But now that Kovalkiewicz just retired Felice Herrig, it looks a little bit better. So for Penne, her last time out, she takes on a UFC debuting Emily Ducote and had no reason nor rhyme or answer for the forward pressure in the boxing of Ducote. And for Penne, it was kind of a flat performance.
This is a weird thing to say, but watching Jessica Penne compete in the year 2022, it'd be like if before UFC 200, instead of doing the Brock Lesnar promo, you see me now! They were like, Tank Abbott's coming back. Like, it really does feel like Jessica Penne is a fighter from a different era. And I know that's weird to say because that era doesn't seem like it was that long ago. We're not talking about the welterweight division back when, like, Josh Koscheck was around. But the women's strawweight division has gone through quite the evolution as of late, especially in the last few years. You sort of have the pre-Wei Li division and the post-Wei Li Jessica Andrade division. Because, like you had said, Karolina Kovalkiewicz, Felice Herrig, Jessica Penne herself, Joanna, like, most of those fighters at this point have either retired or are not even on the back nine, if we're putting it in golf terms. Like, they are putting on the 18th hole. They can see the clubhouse type stuff.
It's steamed hot dog with mustard time.
Exactly. Like, you're ready to just get home. You've been in the sun for 4 hours, ready for a nice nap.
Ripping a doink.
But that's the thing about Jessica Penne. It does feel like she is a fighter from a different era. And with her style, it still feels like she is that same fighter that we saw all those years ago. Her strengths are still her strengths from back then. Very good at head and arm throws. She's not someone who's going to go for a lot of traditional takedowns. We talk about this a lot with women's MMA. Less kind of D1, D2 backgrounds than collegiate wrestling. A lot more judo tosses that you do see in women's MMA. And with Penne, she does like to go to that head and arm choke, and it does help her set up a lot of her own submissions. But that's going to be really interesting to see if she's going to be the one who wants to initiate the grappling with someone like Tabitha Ricci, because I think if this fight is contested in open space, we're going to get a bit of a stinker, if we're being honest. Neither one of these fighters are the most heavy-handed of strikers. They don't really have, you know, knockdown or even knockout power on the feet, but once it does get into the grappling exchanges, I do think this will be an entertaining fight, because for Penne, that's always been her best path to victory, and Ricci reminds me a lot of a Penne, just a few years younger, so we'll be interesting to see if she's able to beat the more mature version of what her own style looks like, that it is a great way for her to crack into the rankings herself.
Well, when I look at this fight, you have comparable athletes that they've each fought in the past, and for Ricci, it's actually her last opponent, Pollyanna Viana. Viana's somebody that holds her hands incredibly low, throws a lot of front kicks and teeps up the middle, and then when you go to take her down, she goes for head and arms, she goes for a lot of guillotines, and that's exactly what Viana did in the fight against Ricci. And for Ricci, she's kind of a 1-2 complete reset type of striker in southpaw. She does have Muay Thai experience, but this is somebody that got into Muay Thai and then overall MMA training about 10 years ago, so she's still very young in her, obviously, her young MMA career. She has that Saiza experience from when she went over to Japan to train, which is something that Yulia Stolyarenko also has a lot of experience in. So we'll touch on that with both of them. But for Ricci, she just fought Pollyanna Viana, who fights very similarly to Penne. And other than getting stuck in those guillotines, then getting the takedown, then just kind of wearing on her for minutes on end from top position, that's how Ricci was able to win that fight. And in terms of a height and a reach advantage, very similar for Viana to Ricci. Now for Penne, she will have a 4-inch height advantage, 5-inch reach advantage. She had similar metrics when she took on Danielle Taylor, who's just 5 feet tall with a 60-inch reach. Very now, cool. Taylor fights completely differently than Ricci. Taylor's on the outside. She's a volume striker from Orthodox, but in and out, pitter patter, that's how Taylor was able to win that fight all those years ago, as Penne was kind of, well, she probably didn't anticipate she was on her way out.
That was a bad fight to rewatch, though. I will say that. That's why we do the work, so you guys don't have to. I was watching Danielle Taylor versus Jessica Penne at like 1:30 a.m. this morning, okay? It was not the best fight to rewatch.
But what I will say, when you do look at it, I mean, listen, for Penne, she trains out of Alliance MMA. There's a lot of grapplers. Her and Angela Hill kind of like locked at the hip in terms of training partners. For Tabitha Ricci, Paragon BJJ. You see her over at Ruka Sport in the camp of Mackenzie Dern, who's in the main event. But you look at it for Ricci, she herself also a black belt in jiu-jitsu. She's also a black belt in judo. So Ricci can go for a lot of different takedowns. She likes, though, the wrestling takedowns, a lot of double legs pressuring, a lot of single legs, because she's not so tall to get the leverage on some of those judo throws. So I look at this as Penne is the type of fighter who off the bottom will threaten with a lot of submission. She does have a very active guard. She will try and transition for a lot of triangles and arm bars for Ricci. She likes to just keep heavy on top, and that is one of the advantages that she'll have over a lot of the women in this division. But Matt, I know the age difference is what it is. It's almost what? Almost a 40-year-old against almost a 28-year-old. The thing about this one is it's very volatile when it does come to their jiu-jitsu, and I would never downplay somebody like Jessica Penne in a matchup like this.
I just think she's not active enough on the bottom for the right purposes. I do agree with you, and I think that's the biggest difference. And I like what you said about how Ricci just fought someone who physically is very similar to Jessica Penne. The difference is Penne is very squirmy on the ground. She will try to move a lot. She's very difficult to hold down, but I do think that's where Tabitha Ricci is going to have success in this matchup. I think if Penne's the one off her back, she can move a lot and at least create enough separation to where, okay, she might be able to threaten with a sweep and whatnot. I still think she'll ever be able to accomplish some of those bigger actions on the mat. And if we do get a fight that just ends up being a lot of Tabitha Ricci in that top control, maybe threatening with a submission once, twice, maybe three times a round, ultimately probably not being able to finish it just because Penne is good defensively, especially with her own grappling, that I do favor the grappling style of Tabitha Ricci, but this could be a weird fight that's very close on the judges' scorecards. We could see a round one where not a lot happens. Both fighters only land 5 or 6 significant strikes, so that's a hard one to judge.
Doesn't that sound like fun, folks?
But you know what I mean. You get a round where you don't really know who won. One fighter convincingly wins second round, the other fighter convincingly wins the third round, and then we just sort of don't know where the judges' scorecards are going to be in the end. I can see a fight that does end up looking like that, but I still like Tabitha Ricci to go out there and get the fight in the positions that she can excel at, whereas Penne, I think, is just going to sort of take what's given to her in this matchup, and if that's the case, I do like Ricci.
Penne struggled with getting the takedowns her last time out against Dakota. She went 0-8 on those, but I never really hammer home the stats all that much in some of these shows. I actually will today, but for Penne, she landed 63 of 244 significant strikes her last time out for a 25% average. That's bad, but when you're throwing so much out versus Ricci, who likes to go 1-2, reset, maybe that could kind of help Jessica Penne in this. So I look at the odds, and when I do say pop and popcorn, this is it. Penne open plus 210, plus 172. If you look at it for Ricci, open minus 250, minus 213. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. They are a surprise to us as they are to you. And I'm going to assume a lot of people have Ricci based on age, based on the win. So I'm going to say over, under 70% Ricci.
I think it'll be slightly over.
I think it's going to be slightly over. It's a lot over. So what is that? 674 total votes, 89% Ricci, 84% by decision. For the 11% that have Penne, 79% by decision. Matt, I see this fight is very close. I like the age. I do like Tabitha Ricci in this matchup because of the top pressure that she's able to accrue when she does get the fight down to the mat. And for Penne, she really has to get those hips and those legs active so she can threaten with the arm bars, threaten with the triangles. I like Ricci's ability to stuff her head down in the chin and the neck area of her opponents once she gets it down. Folks, single strikes, 5 to 6 significant strikes per round, a lot of top control. This is what you're going to get if this goes to plan or how I'm describing it to you. It's not the most aesthetically pleasing fight.
Exactly.
I have Baby Shark to win. Having said that, Penne has a good opportunity in this one with her submissions off bottom, with her volume, not accuracy, but volume. So if you like Penne as an underdog, I won't snicker tee hee on this one. I have Ricci. You have Ricci as well?
Yeah, like Brad Barberina walked out to Baby Shark once, I remember, because he's like, hey, my kids like the song. Tabitha Ricci fights nothing like Brad Barberina, unfortunately. We're not going to get one of those fight of the year style fights. Again, for all the same reasons you had laid out, I like Ricci. A lot of it has to do with her top control on the ground, but should be an interesting fight.
Both of us going with Baby Shark. Doesn't fight like Jacare Souza either. Big time matchup coming up this week. And in the main event, similar, if not the same division, we have Mackenzie Dern taking on Yan Xiao Nan. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Originally scheduled for March of this year and then April. You folks wanted it. You asked for it. You get it. It's 45-year-old Alexei Olenek taking on 39-year-old Ilir Latifi. And the craziest part about this is for Latifi and Olenek, first fight falls apart, second fight falls apart on short notice. Jared Vandera accepts the call,
And Alexei Olenek gets a fight down to the mat.
Did Jared Vandera learn a new submission that night?
Yeah, that was weird. Gets him in a scarf hold and submits him very quickly in the first round. That's Alexei Olenek's 60th victory. He has, what, 47 wins by submission?
That's incredible.
You want another one? 12 wins by Ezekiel choke. He's got two in the UFC, one over Victor Pesta, one over Junior Albini. He has six performance of the night bonuses with the UFC, 9-7 in the UFC. So it's not that great for Alexei Olenek, but the highs are high and the lows have been low. And that's kind of the thing when you look at it for Olenek. Yes, you know, we're going to take this with a grain of salt because the level of competition was very good.
Very.
But Olenek was highly ranked, so you got to fight the good guys. He fights Derek Lewis, almost finishes him, and then doesn't end up finishing him and ends up losing. He fights Chris Daukaus and looks bad and gets finished. And then he fights Sergey Spivak and he loses the decision. Go back and watch that fight. Spivak's going to fight Derek Lewis next. That's fun. We all now understand how good Sergey Spivak is. You don't need the brothers at Fight Night Picks to just sing his praises for years. Holger's now he's up here. To it. But for Alexei Olenek, he got beat pillar to post. Couldn't take the fight to the mat. Really, it could have been finished at multiple points. For Olenek, he finally started to look like a 43, 44-year-old. And then he fights Jared Vandera and he found the fountain of youth again.
That's the thing about Alexei Olenek. When he does fight any of the upper echelon heavyweights at this point in his career, he's just not going to be that competitive with them. Let's just be honest. Because at 45 years of age, he does lack the explosion to go into some of his takedowns. And Alexei Olenek was never one of the highest, you know, level of athletes to begin with. And it's kind of like being like Luka Doncic. You can be really good if you're technical. You don't really have to be really athletic. If you do, just really focus on the margins. And that was always the thing about Alexei Olenek. Had a very unorthodox style of striking, but he made it work for him because you do have
explain
to work.
Explain the unorthodox strike.
He loops strikes over like he's Deontay Wilder, but he doesn't have the power. The weird thing is, though, they do land. Like, I always go back to the Travis Brown fight because it's a good example of Alexei Olenek at his most lethal. He drops Travis Brown with a strike and he submits him with a rear naked choke off the ground. It allows him to sort of showcase both aspects of his striking style. But the problem was, that was all the way back at UFC 213. Like, that was a very long time ago now. And Olenek just isn't that same fighter that he used to be. But in this matchup against Alir Latifi, it will be interesting. Because at heavyweight, Latifi has chosen to wrestle a lot more in this weight division. If you go back to the Tanner Boser fight, close fight, but still, the wrestling of Latifi was definitely enough for him to be able to edge the win out. And if he does decide to start wrestling with a guy like Alexei Olenek, that's how Olenek can get unorthodox with his chokes. You can make one small mistake, he can take a mile, and he ends up submitting you. But the thing is, if Olenek's not the one initiating his own takedowns, being the one who's able to get on top of his opponents, I just don't know if he has enough energy from the bottom position to do one of those big actions to then maybe be able to sweep a guy like Alir Latifi, get on top of him. And the other thing I will say too is, Latifi's striking hasn't looked all that lethal in his UFC tenure at all times. He's not the greatest striker in the world, but when he lands some of those overhands, they are very damaging shots. Again, go back to the Ovin St. Preux fight. OSP and Alir Latifi was like a borderline title eliminator at one point. I know that's a weird thing to say, but both those guys are streaking in the division. Latifi cracks him with a big overhand, hurts OSP on the feet, and when OSP puts his head down, Latifi's able to get him with a really nice guillotine and finish him. I just think Latifi is a good enough grappler to where he won't fall for some of those rookie mistakes that Alexei Olenek can make guys fall for.
And I mean, look at his neck in the picture. Like, that really does help out Alir Latifi. You look at his first overall MMA fight where he takes on Blagoy Ivanov and the ring breaks like it's WWE and like Monday Night Wars with TNT. And you look at Latifi now and it is a lot of single strikes, not really a lot of boxing combinations, a lot of power shots. And Alexei Olenek does, he just throws hammers. Olenek throws wild looping hooks. I used to think Damian Maya kind of struck like that, but it's like if you took Damian Maya and then made him into like some weird fairy tale character. That's what you get with Alexei Olenek. Some guy just coming out of the night, creeping around, throwing his arms out like this. And if he gets a hold of you, oh boy.
Check yourself before you wreck yourself.
He's going to pull you down on top of him and then submit you. Jeez, things that you would never expect. But you consider it for Latifi, his best wins, the OSP win, or the win that he had over Tyson Pedro, just kind of beat him pillar to post. Really good one.
Olenek won't be that much bigger than Alir Latifi either. People got to remember, Alexei Olenek fought Chael Sonnen outdoors and Sherdog all the way back when.
Bodog,
thank you. Olenek's not a big heavyweight, never has been throughout his career. So a lot of these light heavyweights who are going to make the move up to heavyweight and just decide not to cut weight, for lack of a better term, they're going to be the same size physically as Alexei Olenek. And I do expect Alir Latifi, yes, he might have a couple inches, or Olenek might have a couple inches on him, but for
for the most part, these guys are going to look very similar in there. I don't expect Olynyk to have a big heavyweight weight advantage going into this matchup.
And we've seen Aleer Latifi, you know, he was always billed out of All-Stars. Then he went down to Florida to train. Now it seems like he's based at Extreme Couture. I threw up the picture before the last Aleer Latifi fight that was supposed to happen, where he's in the gym wearing a Carmelo Anthony
Knicks jersey,
which is wild, and he's boxing with Francis Ngannou. But for Latifi, it very much is power shots to get the takedown, and then kind of lay and pray with a lot of his takedowns, as it's been
his
lately.
Cardio's not good either.
We do look at the odds in this matchup. A couple of older fellas at heavyweight. Olynyk open a plus 170, plus 150. Latifi open minus 200, minus 180. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us, they are to you, and I have no fucking clue where they're going to be. I'm going to say over-under because the guy's got 47 submission wins. I'm going to say over-under 60% Olynyk.
I think Latifi's going to be the favorite.
Oh, boy. And it's close, and you're right. 707 total votes, 53% Latifi, 39% by decision, 55% by knockout for the 47% that have Olynyk, 81% by submission. So, Matt, the fans have Latifi. The odds have Latifi. Do you have Latifi?
I do have Latifi. I don't feel good about the prediction either, because Latifi's cardio does fall off a effing cliff after about the 7-minute mark in the majority of his fights. So I can see a world where he's going for a lot of takedowns on Olynyk, not really able to accomplish much with those takedown attempts. He finds himself getting tired in the second or third round. Physically, Olynyk's able to wear on him, and you can see a path for Olynyk to be able to get a submission victory as the fight does go to an end. But Alexei Olynyk hasn't made the third round since he fought Fabricio Verdum. And that was a while ago. And that fight was terrible. Let's just call it what it was.
It was the worst.
It was just an awful fight between those two guys. So I do expect Aleer Latifi to be able to defend the takedown attempts from Alexei Olynyk so he can stuff that part of his offense. And I think on the feet, even though I like the striking style of Olynyk, like if you looked at him just throwing punches, you would think, hey, this guy is a net negative on the feet. Even though really, if you look at his whole career, he isn't, just because, again, the threat of the takedown does help him open up a little bit of his own striking. But I do think Aleer Latifi, he's hard to hit clean. The lack of a neck might help him with some of the submission defense, but he does hold his hands quite high. He is difficult to clip clean unless you're like a Volkan Oezdemir who can really put a lot of punches together. So I like Aleer Latifi in this matchup.
I would like Latifi, and as the fans have said with the Tapology votes, if he's going to get the win, maybe he can eke out a decision. If not, he gets a TKO win, and I would think that's got to be an early one, because if you do look at it for Alexei Olynyk, I think back to that first round against Chris Daukaus that went so bad. Standing TKO loss almost happened again against Sergey Spivak if Latifi can get it done. But his hand speed isn't there like those two guys. He doesn't throw nearly as much volume as those two guys. And at heavyweight, he tends to rely on his takedowns, which plays into the game of Aleer Latifi. Which plays into the game of Alexei Olynyk. I'm going with a 45-year-old in 2022, born in 1977. It feels bad, but I'm going to go with Alexei Olynyk. I think that the strengths of Aleer Latifi, the power punching, yes, that's great, but everything else plays into the hands of the older man.
Do you think Olynyk watched Albert Pujols hit 699 and 700 and was like, hey, if he can do it, so can I?
Like, yeah, well, listen, material things, I'll let the fan keep the ball. Alexei Olynyk, what's he going to do if he wins again? Pull his cup out and throw it into the crowd?
That's like, a lucky fan.
That's what somebody wants. Matt, both of us split on the pick. I'm going with Alexei Olynyk. You're going with Aleer Latifi. Let us know down below who gets the win in a battle of men aged, what, a combined age over 80? It's not pretty.
It's not.
Big time fight in the main event. Mackenzie Dern taking on Yan Xiao Nan. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Monstro turned back the clock in his last fight, last time out. First fight since 2017 that Felipe Lins had taken at light heavyweight, where he'd found a lot of his success in life. And if you look at it for Felipe Lins, it was his first win since capping off the PFL's inaugural season, winning the $1 million at heavyweight. Four fights there, four finished wins. For Lins, kind of like Riff Raff, he was showing poor Marcin Prachniau how to be the man.
How to be the man.
No. People like Riff Raff. I like Riff Raff too. And for Lins, he really did look very good in that fight. Had a zip to his step. Looked a little bit like Sam Alvey, because from the first minute had his mouth open as he's striking, which I don't like, especially when you're getting punched in your mouth.
You never want to compare a fighter to Sam Alvey.
But for Lins, the cardio held up until 2 minutes into the second round when both guys looked very, very tired. It was just Lins was able to wear on Prachniau, and Prachniau couldn't do anything with the grappling of Lins. And I really did have a lot of fun going back and watching that fight, watching the tape of where Lins was able to rise up with the PFL. And of course, a lot of people said, well, geez, this guy, like, you go back over his career, he lost to Vadim Nemkov, That's not all that great, but we know how good Nemkov is. Linz has had kind of a crazy career. He trains at American Top Team with some of the best guys in those heavier weight classes that you are going to find. And this guy at 205 physically looked amazing, like washboard abs, grew out the top of his hair, like he was a totally different... He was a totally different looking man. So I really did like that for Linz. He took about 2 years off from the fight against Tanner Boser to his fight that he had against Prakniow. He had 6 total fights fall out, a few of them with BKFC's own Ben Rothwell. But for Linz, were you as impressed as I was out of his last fight against Marcin Prakniow, striker?
Not really. Marcin Prakniow hasn't had the greatest UFC run by any means.
He was on a heater at that point.
That's fine. Marcin Prakniow, if you're impressed by him, that's fine. I have not been. I don't feel afraid to say that at all. Linz looked better, but that's the problem. And this is a weird fight with this aspect. Both guys are coming off a win, but I still feel like they need this win to really be able to get them on the same trajectory that they had when they came into the UFC. Because even for Grecian, it's been a weird run ever since he has come over here. And that's the other odd thing about both these fighters. Both came in as heavyweights into the organization, but decided to then drop down to what I
Time
assume
out.
Is...
No, Grecian came in as a light heavyweight, having also competed in the PFL.
I thought Grecian had his introductory fight at heavyweight.
Took a very, very short notice. What was it? It was on a week's notice against Marcin Tybura. That one was at heavyweight.
Yes, okay, exactly. But that was my thing. Grecian is in this division, but that's the thing. For both guys, they are later in their 30s, so to see them compete at 205 is surprising. But I do agree with you with Linz. Linz looked really good physically the last time going down to the weight class, but that's what I talk about when I mean he's going to need more than just the Prakniow win. If you beat Prakniow in your debut in the weight division, and then you are able to beat a guy like Maxim Grecian, who had a really close fight with Dustin Jacoby, who is one of the better fighters in this weight class, easily, I think. So I think if Linz is then able to get a win over Grecian in that capacity, let's say he is able to wear on him with the clinch, get some takedowns, use some of that good volume that we have seen in the past, I think Linz could have a lot of success at this weight class. But the weird thing is... Is Linz good enough to get into the top 15 of the light heavyweight division? Just because the division is very light, but it does feel like there's a big jump between the ranked fighters and the unranked fighters. And it feels like both guys, it might take them a couple more, even if they are able to get this win, to then get one of those bigger marquee names. Because the division, that like 205 people don't understand just how big of a deal the division was at one point. That was your money fight division. I know it's a while ago when we're talking about the likes of Forrest Griffin and Rampage and Jon Jones, but still, this division not only had some of the best fighters in the world, has some of the biggest names too, and it's just odd to see the light heavyweight division not resemble at all the division that it once was.
And I mean, the age that both these guys are at, like, they could have been fighting at that
exactly.
time. That's a crazy thing. But for Linz, style wise he's very light on his feet, very bouncy, but he is very flat footed on his lead leg, and he does get kicked a lot to that lead leg, does get kicked to the body quite a bit. When Linz decides to unleash with this kind of like hook city walk you forward type of fighting, he does succeed. I mean, it's not necessarily like Dricus Duplessis. He's got a lot more explosion. But for Linz, he will walk you down, throw a lot of hooks, close the distance, kind of like Chris Daukaus does at heavyweight. That's what Linz will do. But then Linz adds that component of, I'm going to wear you down with my body weight in the clinch. I'm going to take you down. I'm going to wear heavy, trying to get your back, trying to get the finish. Linz very much is a finisher. And for Max Grecian, former, what was he, WCFA light heavyweight champ, he did have that loss to Magomed Ankalaev on his record. He's one of those guys, like, you talk about stick-to-itiveness. Max Grecian didn't have the greatest early run to his MMA career. And really got hot late. And in the UFC, lose to Marcin Tybura in a fight that he takes on incredibly short notice. I don't really consider that one all that much. I look at the win that he has against Gad Shimerat and Tigulov, where he finishes him. He loses against Dustin Jacoby, but drops him twice in the first round of that fight. And in the third round, he rallies really well. A lot of the community was split on that fight. And then he goes out there and fights William Knight. Two things to remind you of. When Max Grecian fought Dustin Jacoby, Grecian missed weight and weighed in at 210.5. That's bad. Then when he fought William Knight, Grecian weighs in successfully. William Knight weighed in at 218 pounds. Grecian gets 40% of his purse. All three judges scored at 30-27. He was able to pop back up from the takedown attempts, pop him on the feet. And for Max Grecian, he is a master of sport in army hand-to-hand combat, which is definitely interesting. But for Grecian, something that I talked about as a negative for Felipe Linz that he's usually able to get out of is those leg kicks. Max Grecian might have the best leg kicks at light heavyweight right now, and he also kicks the body. And if you want an example of that, I'll give it to you. Grecian's last fight against Knight went 69 of 89 in his significant strikes. That's 77%. That doesn't happen very often. 32 of the 69 strikes were leg kicks. That's unheard of.
This is why I say that both men really need a win this weekend. They're coming off wins to the likes of William Knight and Marcin Prachniau. Guys who are in the UFC, but we don't necessarily look at them as genuine threats to get into the rankings. And I do think that both these guys had that in their heights when they first came over to the organization. And yes, they faltered, but I think this is a great readjustment fight for both guys. I don't know what the odds are. Normally, I look them up going into these videos, but I did not today. But I do expect them to be very close because I can see a world where Grecian's able to damage Lins a lot on Lins's entries, but if Lins is able to start wearing on him, especially in that second and third round, I think maybe the takedown could start to get to Grecian as this fight continues. I just wonder how long that's going to take and if Grecian can do enough damage before the takedowns really start to come into effect.
Yeah, I mean, William Knight was able to get a few of them, but Grecian was able to pop right back up. That's a big body to try and get off of you, especially at 218. Was Knight his last time out? The odds in this one, they opened at par. Grecian's minus 160, Lin's plus 140 as it stands. Matt, we have a millionaire.
Dude.
But it's not like he found that black gold like they did on Beverly Hillbillies. He was able to win his way to that money. If we do look at Texas T, they call it on that show. But Matt, we do have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprised us there to you. I'm going to say over under 65% Grecian.
I think Lins will be the favorite.
Lins is going to be the favorite. Wow. Grecian's the favorite. 667 total votes, 87% Grecian, 76% by decision, 18% by knockout. For the 13% that have Lins, 57% by decision, 27% by knockout. So odds ever so slightly in Grecian's favor. The fans overwhelmingly have Grecian early on this week. Do you have Lins? You have Grecian.
I have Grecian by like 51% in my mind, 49% Lins. I was very surprised to see where the votes were split up on Tapology. But the thing is, I do like Grecian's ability to do more damage on the feet. I'm not discounting Lins' striking by any means. I think he does have powerful hooks if they are able to land. I just think he's going to have a lot of time in between some of those bigger explosions and some of those bigger moments. And if this fight doesn't end in via stoppage for Lins, I can see Grecian being the one picking up a lot more momentum as this fight continues. I like the leg attacks. I like the body kicks as well from Grecian. So I ever so slightly favor Grecian, but I do see this being a very close fight.
I mean, Lins went 4-0 at the PFL in 2018, 2019, he was injured. He didn't compete in the season. 2020 ends up in the UFC. For Max Grecian, 2018, 2019, he went 4-0-2 over with the PFL. So pretty interesting stuff there. He took that O from Jordan Johnson, the wrestler that was in the UFC at one point. Grecian's takedown defense, I like enough at light heavyweight. I like the damage. I love the leg kicks. And for Felipe Lins, I will say this. The one thing that I really like going back and watching the tape study, he'll switch stances every now and again, go to southpaw, not throw anything, and then he'll switch it up, go southpaw, and then walk forward, switch stances as he does it, and throw out a hook, which is weird. It's almost like a Jorge Masvidal thing, but he's not nearly as fast as Masvidal. So something interesting to watch out of the game of American Top Teams. Lins, both of us going with Maximus Max. Big time fight coming up this weekend in the main event, Mackenzie Dern taking on Yan Xiaonan. Ooh. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it.
Who the f*** is that guy? Who the f*** is that? No, damn, not who I am. Who the f*** is that?
A Jeremy Stephens fight, if I've ever seen one. Coming up this weekend at lightweight, we have Joaquim Silva, Neto BJJ, taking on the body snatcher, Donald Sutherland. Nope, it's another Canadian, Jesse Ronson. And when it comes down to this fight, the reason why I had that audio drop, I don't really mean any disrespect, but for both of these guys, the level of significance of this fight is you get to keep your spot in the UFC.
Pretty much.
And that's pretty much it. And the reason why I had that drop, listen, Tapology rankings don't mean anything, but when you have the 87th ranked lightweight, Silva, taking on the 125th ranked, Jesse Ronson, we are really scraping the bottom of the barrel in this fight.
Joaquim Silva is like a used car at a dealership that looks really good upon first inspection. And the dealer's going to be like, oh yeah, it's great. It's like Paulo Costa, but smaller. And then you're going to like bring it to another garage. Like maybe you have a friend who owns a garage and you're like, hey, I'm going to bring this car by to see if it's all that in a bag of chips. And he just tells you it's full of body filler and it's going to fall apart at any day. Joaquim Silva, again, upon first inspection, is a great fighter. Does he have hand speed? Boy, does he ever. He has great power in his hands, good boxing combinations, doesn't throw enough kicks, but hey, you can't have everything. He's a good BJJ fighter. He has decent wrestling. He's good in the clinch. Again, if you just look at it all surface value, he is pretty good, but the problem is, then you go into the intangibles, the things that separate a good fighter from a great fighter. Is Silva the most durable fighter? No. Does he have good cardio? Not really. Does he have good striking defense? I would disagree with that point as well. So that's the thing with Silva. Are his fights entertaining? They almost always are. He's in that Jimmy Manuel category of kill or be killed. He can win by knockout, lose by knockout, win by submission, lose by submission. And that's why I'm always going to be excited for one of his fights. But we don't talk about Marco Polo Reyes on this channel. And you know why? Because he was a guy who would win by knockout or lose by knockout. And if you do that enough times, you're no longer going to be in the organization. And that's the thing about Silva. I thought, especially early on, he was going to have a promising UFC career. Not saying I thought he was going to be champion or anything like that, but I thought, hey, maybe Silva could get into the rankings because, again, he's good on the feet. He has power. If it does go to the mat, he has the submission ability to be able to clean up a lot of his own messes. The thing is, though, his inability to eat power shots and just to eat power shots.
Whoa. The craziest part about it is, go back and watch Joaquim Silva's last fight. He's taking on Ricky Glenn, and he backs up Ricky Glenn with all of his power shots. I'm not even kidding. Watch the fight. Ricky Glenn hits him from this distance away, and it drops him.
Over.
And then he gets back up, and he goes to his head. He doesn't even... Now, Ricky Glenn's powerful. He's a former featherweight at lightweight. And they were just short, like, very short shots.
He beat the brakes off him.
And it completely floors him. So for Joaquim Silva, we've seen chin issues. We've seen really long layoffs throughout his career. He's a guy that came into the Ultimate Fighter. What was it? Brazil Season 4. He went 4-0 after the show. Had a fight of the night against Jared Gordon where he ends up, you know, looking really
wild
good.
Fight knocks
right
him
down
out.
The stretch, he gets the finish. But you look at the losses. Lost to Vince Pichel by decision. Now, originally, I will say this. On August the 18th, it was supposed to be Vince Pichel versus Jesse Ronson. Pichel's out, in step Joaquim Silva. But you look at it, I mean, he loses to Vince Pichel by decision. He then goes out and loses to Nasrat Haqparast by finish. He loses to Ricky Glenn by finish. The wheels have fallen off Joaquim Silva, but for Jesse Ronson, he came into the UFC, fought with the Score Fighting Series, which is great for us Canadians here. He then goes on, he fights, with BTC, gets a win over, AFC, BTC, AFC.
Not a young guy, is he?
Gets a win over Shane Campbell, and then he punched his short notice ticket into the UFC, and he fights Michelle Prezeris. And the good thing about Jesse Ronson is, he had pre-UFC wins over Jason Sago and Alex Ricci, UFC fighters, also from Canada, so slimish pickings. But for Ronson, he had a good level of competition coming into the UFC. Loses to Prezeris, Francisco Trinaldo, and Kevin Lee, all by split decision. Leaves the UFC. Has a salty run. Loses two fights with the PFL. Now, if you do look at it, he did fight a guy who's a main training partner of Joaquim Silva in Natan Schultz. And in that fight, Ronson's opponent missed weight. Schultz's opponents missed weight. They went, well, do you guys want to fight each other on day's notice? He takes that fight. He loses that fight. That's fine.
The old Nate Diaz, Tony Ferguson.
He loses to Nikolai Alexiakhin by finish. He then goes out and with BTC beats Troy Lamson. So there's my point that I was mixing up in my mind. And then he comes in on short notice up a weight class and fights Nicholas Dalby. And it was competitive at the start. And then he drops Dalby. And Dalby's sometimes usually like a fish out of water on the ground. And Ronson's able to, in the exchange, from mount to back mount, off the side, get a rear naked choke. It's a really weird submission. He gets a performance bonus. He tests positive. Tainted supplement, so he claims. But he finished all the supplements, so they couldn't test it. So Ronson accepts a ban. And then his last time out, fights Rafa Garcia and got ground out. For Jesse Ronson, it hasn't been good in the UFC. It's been wishy-washy outside of the UFC. I can't paint a great picture out of this fight because it very much is like flip your coin and make your pick.
Because again, Silva's going to look good until he doesn't. I can see a world where he drops Ronson, has him hurt, looks really good. And then all of a sudden, midway through the second round, Ronson lands an uppercut, finishes Silva. And I look like an idiot forever thinking Neto BJJ would win this fight to begin with. But the thing about Silva is he does have a solid skill set. Like if you just look at what he does well and doesn't do well inside the cage, I can't take anything away from his boxing. I can't take anything away from his grappling. And since I do like the foundation of his game, I can see a world where he looks really good in this fight until he doesn't, like I just said. So for me and a prediction on this one, the weird thing about Ronson is he does have good submission abilities, but he has been susceptible to the submission in the past. So if Silva has him hurt, then I could see Silva winning by submission. If he has Silva hurt, I could see him winning by submission. That's why it is so volatile going either way. But I still like the overall skill and game plan out of Silva. I never thought that was a sentence I'd utter on this channel, but I think that he does have good enough power on the feet to where if he doesn't eat one of those big knockout blows, he'll be able to do enough damage throughout this fight to be able to at least win rounds.
The fucking guy sees red every fight.
He does.
his biggest attribute, and it's also his biggest downfall. For Jesse Ronson, you talk about complete skill sets. You look at Ronson, he was a former double champ with TKO in Quebec. He trains out of Adrenaline Mixed Martial Arts in Ontario. He's out of London himself, which is where the gym is. Mark Hominick's gym. You've seen Bazooka Joe Valtellini in that gym as well. We're talking about Canadian icons.
Canadian all-star, dude.
When you look at it for Jesse Ronson, though, kickboxing being pretty well the base, and he does throw a lot of kicks, and he will throw them to all three levels. So I do like that out of Ronson, just an added component to his game. You look at the odds here, Silva open a -170, -155. You look at it for Ronson, open +145, +125. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us, there to you. I'm going to say over under 65% Joaquim Silva, but this is quite literally the most volatile matchup I think I've ever tried to break down in Fight Night Picks history.
When it can finish via any of the four true outcomes, we need to start coining that. Like in baseball, three true outcomes, four true outcomes. Knockout win, submission win, knockout loss, submission loss for either guy. That's how this fight could go. Of course, if it goes to a decision, it's probably going to be a weird split decision because both guys are able to do enough damage. I know it's a weird thing to say. Just this is a very even fight between two guys who are good. They have good skill sets. They just, again, they lack some of the intangibles that you look for when you think about ranked fighters in this division, especially in lightweight. But I do still have Joaquim Silva as the official prediction.
So over under?
Oh, sorry.
65%? You're thinking it's Silva?
I think it's going to be over. Yeah.
All right. It okay. is over. 660 total votes. 82% Silva. 65% by decision. 12% by submission. 17% by knockout. I'm not here to say that that equals 100%, but it is what it is in Tapology. For the 18% that have Ronson, 49% by decision. 38% by knockout. I have Joaquim Silva. I assume he's going to be able to take it down to the mat, but just pop and popcorn
no
this one. Yeah, not a lot of confidence in this one, but these are the ones we need to hear from you down below in the comments section. Let us know who you have in this matchup. Both of us going with Neto BJJ and not our fellow Canadian in this one because a lot of people are just so down. Oh, you guys took Barrio to beat Hernandez. You don't know anything about fighting. Listen, we don't like to take Canadians, and sometimes you just don't like to take a Canadian, but you do in that matchup. In this one, we are not. You let us know who you have in the comments. And in the main event, Mackenzie Dern taking on Yan Xiaonan. Co-main event, Rude Boy Randy Brown, Masaran Duba, Francisco Trinaldo. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Nick Diaz Army represent. We have the UFC debut of Caesar Gracie Jiu-Jitsu's own Chelsea Chandler repping the 209 for Chandler. She's on a 4-fight win streak. She lost her pro debut. She's going to be taking on Yulia Stolyarenko, who was previously 0-4 in the UFC. She got a first round armbar win very quickly over Jessica Rose Clark her last time out. She had become a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt back in November of last year. Did Stolyarenko. You know her as being a fighter from the Art of Nine Limbs. She had Lethwei experience. She has Saiza experience over in Japan. She was on The Ultimate Fighter. She really does have one of the strangest skill sets to translate in MMA.
Have you ever met anybody, sorry, who's gone like, hey, do you know what I do on the weekends? I do Lethwei. Like, I know people who do jiu-jitsu. I know people who box in their spare time. I've never met anyone who's like, I love headbutting people on every, like, Sunday.
Just watching Zidane highlights, getting excited about MMA. But for Yulia, that really is her base. That's where her bread gets buttered. Her striking very much is car crash-esque. You watch her fight where she won the Invicta Bantamweight title against Lisa Verzoza. And that's a different fighter than the fighter that normally fights because for Stolyarenko, it very much is ha-ha, with a kick, reset, wait, bait your opponent in, try and land more shots. Against Verzoza, they both went balls to the wall. Verzoza had one of the nastiest cuts I've ever seen in my life. It wasn't like Song Yadong or it wasn't like Gregory Rodriguez, but it was in that avenue. So Stolyarenko looked really good there. She comes into the UFC. She loses to Kunitskaya in one of the oddest game plan fights I've ever seen. She loses to Julia Avila where she gets finished. She loses to Alexis Davis where she gets ground
That's
out.
That's when I jumped off the train.
Which could offer Chelsea Chandler a method of victory. But for Stolyarenko, she had three or four of the tightest armbars I've ever seen. It's just that old lady, you know, Davis has some of the most flexible shoulder joints and elbows I've ever seen. For Stolyarenko, out of all of her submission wins, they're all by armbar, which might really kind of make you question things a little bit. So let's shift over to Chelsea Chandler. She does, of course, fight out of that Caesar Gracie gym. She was originally supposed to take on Leah Letson, but back in July 31st, it was announced that Stolyarenko was going to take the fight, so full camps for both of these women. I listened to an interview with MMA Sucka and James Lynch not that long ago from Chelsea Chandler while she was driving. Don't do interviews while you drive. The audio quality's never good, and you gotta focus on the road. But what I will see out of it was this is what I gained. She's been training lots of armbar simulations, lots of getting the fight to the mat and staying in that open guard and trying to land her own damage. She's been training at CSA Gym, which is where, oddly enough, Jessica Rose Clark trains, but some of the main training partners, Leslie Smith and Carrie Melendez. So a lot of speed and a lot of striking. The other thing that I have out of this one, and I am going to read this word for word. This is what Chandler said. She said, this fight's going to be a catchweight at 140 pounds. And when James Lynch pressed her, she said, we had found some medical issues. I've been having some issues with my thyroid. So that was kind of the reason why my weight wasn't going down at first. She would consider a move to 145 pounds. She's fought her last two fights at 145 before that at bantamweight. So an interesting one for Chelsea Chandler. This one.
I remember Katsangana had talked about that a lot when she had been cutting weight before she'd left the UFC. It just seems to be a problem that a lot of female fighters run into, unfortunately, but that's never a promising thing to hear when you do have a fighter being forced to take one of these weird catchweight fights, because other than the last pay-per-view that we just had, the UFC doesn't really like to do a lot of these catchweight bouts because in the grand scheme of things, they just mean the fight themselves matter a lot less because you don't really know what division rankings to put them under. But I can be 100% honest with this. I've had a bad read on Stolyarenko in her UFC career. I thought she was going to lose her last fight to Jessica Rose Clark. But the thing is, Jessica Rose Clark isn't good at defending submissions. So if you are going to beat her, submitting her via an armbar off your back is probably going to be one of the best methods. So for Stolyarenko, it's kind of like what I said between the fight between Grecian and Felipe Lins. Still an important fight, even though both fighters are coming off a win. And I look at this fight for Stolyarenko in a very similar capacity. You can't officially get your first UFC win and then go on to lose to somebody making their organizational debut. It's not the best look for Stolyarenko, but it will be interesting to see how she does decide to fight this fight, because I do expect her to have an advantage on the feet with some of her striking.
Really?
I do, and I know it is a lot of that car crash striking, but I just think that type of a striking can make what happens on the feet at least close enough to where the grappling is going to matter more than anything on the feet, I should say that. So for Chandler, I think she can have success, but I think this fight's primarily going to be contested on the mat, and if Stolyarenko is able to get that top position, I didn't talk about the armbars a lot, which is a surprising stat, the fact that that's basically the only way that she does win via submission, but she does have good top control in her fight. She is a very tricky fighter off her back. We talked about Jessica Penne earlier on in the card. Penne's someone who's going to squirm a lot and try to make it very difficult for herself to be held down, whereas Stolyarenko is going to attack a lot more with some of her own submissions off of the ground, and I can just see this being an awkward fight where there's a lot of entanglements of a lot of limbs, and it's both fighters kind of going for their own stuff. And if it does result into one of those fights, I think it's going to be a really difficult one to score at the end of it. Because again, if it's Stolyarenko going for submissions, Chandler's good enough to get out of it. Maybe she's able to land some ground and pound in the top position. I think we're just going to get a lot of even rounds into
so
these two fights.
So Stolyarenko doesn't get a lot of top position in a lot of her fights.
I think in this matchup, she can. Again, if anything's contested on the mat, I think she's going to be the much more active between these two fighters.
I think you have a bad read on this one. I think for Chelsea Chandler, growing up, our stepdad used to have a poster upstairs, and it had one Brian McCabe. You know exactly what
it said.
It said exactly, the best offense is a good defense. And for Chelsea Chandler, she lives life the opposite way. The best offense is more offense and more offense and more offense. Chelsea Chandler, in her fights, walks these women down, throws complete caution to the wind. If you like Leslie Smith fights,
they're just going to clinch because of that, I think.
You'll like Chelsea Chandler fights. She just throws and throws and throws and throws and clinches and gets a takedown and then throws and throws. And then if he gets back up, she throws and throws some more. If you look at these fights that she's had, her last time out, she beats Courtney King by decision. The two wins before that, Brittany Victoria, she drops her twice. She gets a finish by knockout. Olivia Parker, she drops her. And as Parker's days, she gets her and submits her. In her fight against King, so that was her last fight against Courtney King. 50-50 on the feet. She does get kind of a little bit dazed in that one. And that was kind of the trouble that I had. The fight against Olivia Parker. I mean, she's dropping her with a left cross. She goes to the body quite a bit, which you do like to see out of her dips. But against King, I mean, it was what, the second round, she gets dropped by an awkward short left hand. And then she kind of pops back up, but she runs away and then gets hammered on a little bit more. Chandler, very, very active, very, very heavy with her takedowns, good top pressure. I think Chelsea Chandler is a lot better of a striker. She lands a lot more volume. She will get cracked, but she, again, She throws away all of her striking defense for all of her striking offense. Both of them car crash. Chandler has better wrestling, better top control, but I think Stoyarenko can take advantage when it does come to the mat.
I know, that's basically what I said. I think, no, on the feet, you're right, but you're not listening to me. Chandler can be the better striker, but her type of striking is going to invite a lot of the grappling exchanges between these two. I still think we're going to see a lot of minutes for Chelsea Chandler using her footwork, really pumping the jab on the outside, being able to extend a lot of these exchanges with her striking. I think her striking is going to get her into a lot of these clinch positions, and if that is how the fight goes, I think it's going to be a really close fight from that position, because Stoyarenko off her back, very dangerous, on top, very dangerous. If Chandler is just trying to go in there looking for the finish and being that aggressive fighter like we have seen, I do worry about her a little bit trying to tire herself out in that top position in the open guard of Stoyarenko. If Chandler isn't able to damage Stoyarenko enough to really be able to get the judges in her favor earlier on in this fight, I can just see the window for Stoyarenko winning by submission to become slightly more open and slightly more open as this fight progresses, because everything comes down to the touches with Stoyarenko. She's not somebody who's just going to go in there, dominate you with her grappling. It is going to come down to, okay, how are your arms in this exchange? How are your feet and how's your base in some of these engagements? And that's where Stoyarenko can shine through. And that's why I do like her in some of these close range striking, or not just striking, but grappling exchanges.
Chandler has a nice record. And if you look at the level of opposition, she's 4-1 out of all of it, 2-0, 2-0, 3-0, 4-0, and 4-2. So 15-2 is the combined record of her opponents. Look at the 15-2, go through those records. They are a little bit chintzy, I will just say that. And for Chandler, you beat a 38-year-old Olivia Parker here not that long ago. It is what it is. You're getting wins. You're winning the way that you should. Beats King not that long ago. They signed her directly to the UFC. The Letson fight was supposed to be what it would have been. And Letson hasn't won over Yulia Stoyarenko, so there is that. But
that season of Tough did not produce the stars they thought, did it?
Well, Chasson hasn't looked great either. But we have a look at the odds. Stoyarenko open as the underdog, plus 130, minus 160. Chandler open as the minus 150. She's minus 106. When odds like that switch with unranked women's fighters, usually the underdog wins. So it could be good for Chelsea Chandler. But we have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise us here to you. I'm going to say Nick Diaz Army represent. I'm going to say Chelsea Chandler gets the fan support over under 65% Chandler.
I think it'll be under 65.
It's going to be under. Oh, you salty dog. 676 total votes, 64% Chandler. 87% by decision for the 36% that have Stoyarenko, 42% by decision, 51% by submission. I think Yulia Stoyarenko wins this fight. The reason being, I think the jiu-jitsu is the X factor. I know Chandler trains at a big jiu-jitsu gym. She cross-trains at all of these good gyms. The striking could win her fights in the UFC. It could also really lose her fights in the UFC. I look at Chandler in a fight against somebody like another unranked fighter, like a Jocelyn Edwards. She'd really struggle at that range against Edwards. Now, Chandler has the takedowns. Edwards struggles with the takedown defense, so Chandler could win there. But Chandler does hold her hands like down by her waist, between her chest and her waist, and just fire power strikes the entire time. And it's not a style that's conducive to longevity in the UFC. It could work at featherweight because there's not a lot of featherweights. It could work at bantamweight. We could see, but I don't necessarily love it that way. I think I've had a read on Stoyarenko through the UFC, and I liked her against Jessica Rose Clark. I like her in this matchup against Chandler. I just think her jiu-jitsu can win her a fight like this. And car crash striking, Stoyarenko's chins, I think she's going to be able to get the win this weekend.
So do I. I think Stoyarenko is the much more dangerous fighter once it does hit the mat. I think Chandler can have some positions where she does have success in, but I think for the most part, Stoyarenko is going to be the one who's threatening with a lot more on the mat, and that's why I like her in this matchup.
Both of us going with Lithuania's Yulia Stoyarenko to get the win, but if you like the Cesar Gracie product in Chelsea Chandler, let us know down below in the comments section. The fans certainly do. Big time fights coming up this weekend, including Rude Boy Randy Brown taking on Masaran Duba, Francisco Trinaldo, and in the main event, Dern versus Zhao Nan. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Fringe middleweight contenders looking to get back up into the top flight. We have the former LFA middleweight champ, all in Brennan Allen, taking on Poland's Krzysztof Żabko. Couple of guys looking to keep it rolling and make three fight win streaks. And for one of them, they're going to lose unless we get a draw. That's a bit of a tongue twister of a brain blender. Brennan Allen, I mean, what can I say about this guy? He has had a tidy run. He debuted as a pro at 19 years old. I mean, he's what? He's 26 right now. He's a fan of the channel. So, Brennan, I'm sure you're out there. But for him, he's a 2015 IMMAF amateur world champion. You like to see that in middleweight. It's a good lineage. I mean, his what? Third pro fight? He was taking on Trevin Giles already. Like, he really did get a fast track. He fights on Dana White's Contender Series. He ends up in the UFC. And so far, out of the whole run, it's been pretty good. I mean, he loses to Sean Strickland by finish. He has that loss, three fights ago against Chris Curtis. But he was able to pick up the pieces once more. And if you look at the 5-on-in for Brennan Allen, it's a win over Carl Robertson by finish. It's a win over Puna Soriano. The loss to Curtis. The win over Alvey, where knock him down, drag him out, submits him. And then a fight against Jacob Malkoon, where Malkoon puts on his wrestling shoes, because that's what he has.
Bad guy to do it against.
And Brennan Allen gets taken down a little bit, but he makes his strikes account for more on the feet. We've seen different iterations out of Brennan Allen. We've seen the I'm a grappler, you're a grappler, Kyle Daukaus fight. We've seen the I'm Bangkok ready, Brennan Allen, where
look good against Puna Helly that way.
Shows up with his Muay Thai against Puna Soriano. We've seen kind of a mix of everything in between. We've also seen Allen struggle against pressure strikers in a Sean Strickland, which Christophe Jaco, look at all of his wins and look at all of the decisions. Jaco can fight that way. And Jaco also fought Sean Strickland and lost as well. So it is a bit of a tough nut to crack in this matchup, because stylistically you could get any different variation of Brennan Allen. Whereas for Christophe Jaco, I'd say you're just going to get just the kickboxer Christophe Jaco, but he out-grappled Jiro Mearshart his last time out. Who thought that would have ever happened? Not me.
I don't think we're going to see that version against Brennan Allen. I will say that. But this is a very interesting fight, just because Jaco's one of these strikers who is a great striker. Don't get me wrong. Technically, very, very high level. He's just not the most powerful guy on the feet. You look at what he's able to do with some of his combinations, and you would assume that when they land, they have devastating effect on his opponents. They just never really do. And it is an odd thing to see from a guy who does throw a lot of volume, who does throw a lot of crazy, like, hook kicks, axe kicks, stuff like that. Christophe Jaco has pretty much every kind of kick in his repertoire. It's just not like a Luke Rockhold. When they land, you don't hear a crazy thud that sounds like two wooden baseball bats are hitting each other. But that's the weird thing about Jaco. He's just very good defensively in most aspects of MMA, and that's why it's very difficult to go out there and beat a guy like him on decision. Because you're going to have to expect to, okay, you're going to absorb 150 strikes. He's going to be moving around all over the place because he does have good footwork. The thing is, though, when Jaco does get put into some very specific situations, he does struggle with them. For instance, the great footwork can be diminished if you get him up against the cage. He's someone who will kind of jump left to right and be less of a traditional fighter when he has his own back up against the cage. And that's where we've seen him eat some very damaging shots from guys who aren't even all that heavy-handed themselves. I always go back to the Brad Tavares fight. Jaco's fighting very well. He's doing a good job with his volume. But when Tavares is able to get him up against the cage and eliminate some of that good footwork from Jaco, it does make him a lot more hittable in that range. But for Jaco, like you had mentioned, the new wrestling wrinkle to his game might be one that we do see a lot more often. Maybe that is his answer too. You're a power puncher. You're finding a way to get on the inside of my range. Well, what's my answer now? I can't really get you off with my hand speed or my power. I can duck underneath, go for the takedown, and that will at least switch it up in my opponent's mind. I just don't know if Jaco is going to have that opportunity against a guy like Brennan Allen, who might be susceptible to the takedown, don't get me wrong. But when you do end up grappling with him for some of these longer engagements, that's when Brennan Allen can really shine. I even go back to the Kevin Holland fight where he gets hurt early. Shout out to Kevin Holland. Don't know if he did retire or not, but maybe he did. No, he didn't.
It's sad. Well, he put on his Instagram, I'm almost 30. Thanks for the cheese. It's over. But Allen gets hurt by Kevin Holland. He's in very bad shape early in that fight. And what's he able to do? Holland gets his back. Looks like he's going to win by submission. Brent Allen fights out of that situation and then is able to get the rear naked choke on a guy like Kevin Holland. I just think Allen is a lot more devastating when it comes to his grappling in this matchup. And that's why I do expect Jaco to go back to a more of a volume striking game plan.
Yeah, and I think Mearshart's a much more devastating grappler than Christophe Jaco. But that doesn't take away the fact that Jaco was able to take the fight to the mat, control large portions of that fight, and get the win.
We have seen Gerald Mearshart be controlled on the mat. Yes, he can get a lot of submission wins. He's a phenomenal defensive grappler. But, like, even Dustin Stoichfuss was able to hold him down for moments in their fight before he was able to get that submission win.
The weird part about it, though, for Jaco, late career kickboxer, decision fighter, I think there's one guy that he trains with that really, really helps him out, especially for a matchup like this. He has Thiago Alves. You're going to work some of the striking. He has Rafael Carvalho, the former Bellator middleweight champ. He is Johnny Eblen, the current Bellator middleweight champ. What does Johnny do? Johnny wrestles and grounds guys out. That's a perfect
guy to replicate Brennan Allen in a matchup like this. And for Brennan Allen, we've seen different iterations. He's trained in Colorado. He's trained all over the place. He's out of Louisiana originally. Killcliffe FC, we've seen a little bit more of an evolution with his hands, with his striking.
More kicks.
He definitely is a devastating striker. And when you look at it, we threw this one out there to the YouTube community tab because we were away for a week and we needed some stuff to do. So middleweight scrap, UFC Vegas 61, who gets it done? This one was not a poll. This one was you guys talk about it. MPTV, Craig and Matt, I was wondering if you guys are safe. Best regards to you and your families.
We good.
New Brunswick, for the most part, was good. In the East, though, Pointe-du-Chêne and Shediac didn't fare so well. So hopefully the communities over there are doing well. Hopefully all that are in Cape Breton, especially Sydney area, as well as Port-au-Basque and Newfoundland. Hopefully everybody's safe and sound there because Hurricane Fiona was devastating. So MPTV, that's appreciated. Hopefully everybody in Atlantic Canada is doing well. Dan Goldstein, Jocko via vicious, devastating, brutal point fighting for three rounds. Be up there with Usman's toe stomps for pure violence and excitement. Chad, the UFC dad, feel it win for either is a great step for a title run in a shallow division. You'll say Allen. Bill, who's always out there in the comments saying Jocko lost three in a row and looked like he was out of the UFC and now he's 4-1 his last five. And I stopped losing money picking against them. Allen's on a similar run, but the level of competition is much lower. And Love Jesus is saying, Allen is a... Ugh. I'm shocked he's the underdog. Jocko has a puncher's chance only. Matt, this is a really tight fight. The odds in this one, Allen opened to minus 125. They're at par now. Jocko opened plus 105. We're talking odds being at par. We have a look at the topology votes. Surprise us, they are to you. Fan favorite is the 7-2 UFC fighter, Brennan Allen. I'm going to say the fans probably have him 65% over under Allen.
I think it'll be under.
I think it's going to be under. Well, it is under. 744 total votes, 61% Allen, 75% by decision. For the 39% that have Jocko, 85% by decision, who do you think gets it done here?
It's a really weird fight because Jocko's going to look good until he doesn't. And if this fight does end inside the distance, without a doubt, Brennan Allen's going to be the one getting the finish victory. He has shown an evolution with his striking on the feet, but this has been my issue with Brennan Allen, especially within this run of his career. He is a very high-level fighter. I don't think anyone would disagree with me with that. But he never fights the way you think he's going to fight. Every time I think he's going to go in there, put on the wrestling shoes, show us the really dominant grappling that he has been able to show us in the past, that's when he goes out there flicking the jab, looking for the body kick. And yes, his striking has come a long ways from the fighter that we first saw in the UFC, but I still prefer the grapple heavy version of Brennan Allen. Even though I like that he's been able to work on those skills and develop those skills, I still think of Allen's best path to victory as a grappler and less of a striker, and I just like the striking to help him bridge the gap between those two areas. I think Allen can get the offensive takedown on Christophe Jocko, though. That's the one thing about this fight that I think is going to be difficult for Jocko. I think he's going to be able to get a lot of good volume numbers up when they are in the middle of the cage. But I think at a certain point, whether it's 1 minute left, 3 minutes left in the round, at some point, Allen probably is going to get those hands clasped behind Jocko. And it really will just become a case of, can Allen get enough work done with however much time he has left on the mat to make up the difference that Jocko was able to get in the middle of the cage? Again, it's a tough fight. The odds reflect that because it is even odds. Ever so slightly, I'm going to favor Christophe Jocko in this matchup. I came into this really thinking that I was going to predict Brennan Allen, but I do like the overall footwork of Jocko. I think it's going to be difficult for Allen to, like I said, get a lot of those volume numbers up before he is able to get one of those takedowns and do some work on the mat. And for that reason, I do think Jocko, and you hate to pick a fight this way, but like our commenter said, death by a thousand cuts basically is how Christophe Jocko likes to fight. I do expect him to use a lot of that volume, and I think it's takedown defense will be good enough to defend the takedowns early in the rounds, because I think that's really what it comes down to. If Jocko gets taken down with 4 minutes left in a round, he's going to lose that round and probably get diced up on the mat. If he can prevent the takedowns until the last minute or so, I think he can be sound enough defensively to at least not lose the round based on
look
that.
At Jocko's last two fights. It's very bizarro. Misha Serkinov takes him down five times. Serkinov, all he did was grapple, and Jocko wins the fight because he struck a little bit. Like, it was a close fight.
Not a good one.
Here nor there, not a great one. Then he fights Jiro Meerschaert, and he's the grappler. And for Jocko, career-wise in the UFC, and he's been around for a very long time, 83% takedown defense, training with Alves and Johnny Eblen. Like, that's a really good power
combo.
Is
he the Alex Caceres of the division?
Yeah.
He's been around for a while. He's well-rounded. He can offer anybody a tough fight.
No,
but in the grand scheme
no.
of things, you don't think Jocko's going to break through.
Caceres went on that big win streak, and there were guys like Austin Springer peppered in there. For Jocko, the win streak has guys that you know and love, like Marc-Andre Barrio and Jeremy Mearsher.
Like, they're borderline-ranked fighters. You just don't really expect them to break through.
I guess. But when I do look at this one for Brennan Allen, you talk about it. Never knowing what a game plan is, sticking to a game plan, and when the wheels fall off, boy, do they fall off. Wins or losses for Brennan Allen, I can get a little bit squirrely. I like him for the finishing ability, so I'll take him here because I think he's a little bit more well-rounded. But for Jocko, again, if he wins, decision. If Allen wins, maybe you could see a decision, but I do like the grappling handles out of Allen in a matchup like this, where it could be close.
I think it will be. Again, for me, it just comes down to how early can Brennan Allen get the takedown in every round. If he has 3 minutes to work on the clock, I do expect him to be able to get a lot of that ground and pound off and make Jocko a lesser version of himself as the fight continues. But again, if there's only 45 seconds left in the round and Allen is able to get on top, I still think that's going to be enough time for him to really be able to make a difference with some of the striking Jocko is able to do, but a very closely contested fight.
Matt going with Poland's Krzysztof Jocko. I'm all in on Allen. We have a big time fight in the middleweight division this weekend. Let us know and pepper us some more with those comments down below. Who do you have in this matchup? In the main event, we have Mackenzie Dern taking on Yan Xiaonan. Coming up near the top of the strawweight division, you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. It's the make or break fight of the lifetime for the Peanut Butter Cup King, the Zohan, Randy Costa, and he's going to be taking on Our Town MMA's own, Argentina's favorite son. He's almost 43 years old. It's Guido Canetti, and we're going to take you on a trip down memory lane for Guido Canetti, because you all laughed at me. You out there, 81% of you on Topology, and boy, were there a lot of votes, Matt. They all had Chris Moutinho to beat Guido.
Loves patting himself on the back.
Guido's going to go out there and get that win. You didn't think it was going to happen. But for Guido, he finally does get the win. And this guy has had the weirdest run in the UFC. That's got to be said. This guy was fucking 35 on the Ultimate Fighter. And they went, hey, let's just keep him around. He went 0-2 on the show. But should he fight Henry Briones? Yeah, let's do it. And for Guido, in the UFC, 3-5 since the Ultimate Fighter Latin America season 1. He was 0-2 on that season. He very much was the Austin Lane before Austin Lane from Dana White's Contender Series. Because you got to remember, Austin just won. He's 34, turning 35 next month. Guido was 35 getting into the UFC. Maybe Austin can kick around for that long.
Joel Romero made his debut at 36.
So. Well, for Guido, I mean, I go through all of his fights. I mean, he did look really good against Chris Moutinho. He was throwing the crisp leg kick, the crisp body kick. You know and love Guido for that thunderous leg kick and body kick early in his fights. But he doesn't normally last as fights go on. And that's Guido's biggest hole. And in the fight against Chris Moutinho, he was really lunging for a lot of his hooks. He was landing. Moutinho's knocked out on his feet. The commentary, they weren't too hip to the finish as it happened. But then Moutinho was definitely out in the last, like, in the 10 seconds preceding the finish. So you look at it for Guido, the 3-fight losing streak that he had kind of going into that fight. Lost a year ago to Mana Martinez, looked great in the first round, looked good in the third round, didn't look good in the second round. Mana had the kind of extenuating circumstances around the fact that his coach had just passed away before that fight. For Guido, before that, lost to Chito Vera and a loss to Dana Bakari. But for Guido, it very much is, I gotta get it done in the first round, or that's about all she wrote.
Guido Canetti's the perfect do you still belong in the UFC or not fighter, because if you beat him, then hey, you belong. If you lose to him, there's a reason we don't often talk about 43-year-olds in the bantamweight division. Fighters at this weight division tend to age a lot faster than they do in heavyweight. Why is that? Well, power tends to be the last thing that goes when you're an athlete. So, in the heavyweight division, where power is, it kind of reigns king, you can last very long in that weight division. Whereas in bantamweight, when you need things like cardio and speed, two things you don't often have in your early 40s as a professional athlete, it does become a little bit concerning, but Guido Canetti did look really good his last time out against Moutinho. I know I had picked Chris going into that matchup, and the fact that Canetti was able to land such powerful shots so early on in that fight was a really promising thing to see, because, okay, at least Guido still has his X factor. That hasn't left him just yet. That's a really important thing for any fighter. I just don't know if he's going to be able to go in there and get such a quick finish, a guy like Randy Costa, who, it is interesting, both these guys do suffer from the same weaknesses. Randy is a guy who, if you get really close to him, you can outbox him. He doesn't really have the greatest answer for some of the close range strikes of his opponents, but he's really good at that kickboxing range. He's great at going to the legs, great at going to the bodies. Really is a 3-level striker when it does come to his own kicks. But the thing about Costa is, When you throw kicks, they take a lot more of your energy than punches do. There's a reason a lot of people jab. It does take a lot of energy to jab, and it's still a strike. Whereas with Costa, it's a lot of big actions. And if he's not able to land those really big actions, he does tend to tire very fast as these fights go on. And everybody's going to remember that Adrian Yanez fight, because that was a fight that was, hey, these two uber prospects, like if they ever fight again, it'll be at the top of the rankings. Maybe Adrian has separated himself a little bit from Randy, but just think about the first round in that fight. Randy was able to damage Adrian Yanez pretty badly, for being honest. He had his nose bloody, he was kicking his legs apart. He was looking really good, but again, the issue is, when guys are able to solve his range and get on the inside of it, that's when Costa does struggle with what that plan B or plan C is going to be. And against Guido, it's really just going to come down to, can Guido get on the inside of that range before that second round comes around? Because, and it's wild to say this based on his last two fights, but I think I do ever so slightly favor the gas tank of Randy Costa. I think a little bit does come down to a pacing issue more than just a naturally having poor cardio. I think if he does just slow down a little bit in that first round, have smarter shot selections, then he won't fall off a cliff like we have seen as of late. But this is a very important fight for Randy Costa. And I know it's weird because the loser might not be in the UFC, but it still feels more important for Randy Costa than it does for Guido Canetti. Canetti's been around. He's done that. He is on the end of his UFC career. Nobody expected Randy Costa to go on a 3-fight losing streak and be wondering if he would still be in the organization.
This is the craziest thing about Randy Costa. Coming into the UFC, it was a level of competition. It was really bad, and I can give you the numbers if you want, but this is the third rebuild of Randy Costa. And you might say, well, geez, I mean, Craig, it's like his record's not that bad, but okay, so he loses to Brandon Davis. It is what it is. He beats Journey Newsome. That was a really good win. He gets the win over Boston Solomon, where he drops him twice. In the fight against Boston Solomon, I heard Daniel Cormier say something that had never occurred to me before in any of these videos and watching Randy Costa. He throws the same thing all the time and goes back to the well in every single fight. And he will, because if you watch Randy Costa fight, his footwork's a lot different than Guido Canetti's. Guido Canetti's very much, I'm going to try and cut you off, or I get backed up. But I stay kind of to that left side. I stay in my southpaw stance. He's very rigid. He throws a lot of power. He plants on a lot of his shots. Randy Costa doesn't plant on a lot of a shot. Randy Costa is very much like, ooh, I'm happy feet, I'm baby deer legs, I'm all over the place. I land one good one. Well, geez, I better go back to that well. If I land a right cross, well, then I'm going to throw another right cross. And in that fight against Solomon, he just kept doing it, and he landed two knockdowns, right crosses there every single time. Journey Newsom, quick finish. Good mixing it up against Adrian Yanez until everything started to fade in the second round. Against Tony Kelly, he loses the first round, and then in the second round, he gets backed up. He loses his range. Kelly gets it down to the mat, elbows to the head and everything else, and he gets the finish. What I have in this one, the good for Costa. Well, he's 3 inches taller, and he's got 5 inches of reach. The bad out of all of it, sometimes he can get cornered, and his takedown defense isn't all that good when he gets backed up, nor is his striking defense. The good, all of his fights are by finish, which is good, because he's got more wins than losses. But the bad, the opponent's record combined in all of his wins, even with the UFC wins, Boston Solomon had a positive record, so did Journey Newsome. 20-18. And
the thing is, though, even if he beats Guido Canetti, you can still say that after the fact.
And it is true. So it really is a chintzy call when you get down to it. The last time he fought a southpaw, that was Boston Solomon, who had good boxing, and he was able to figure out that riddle there. So Costa does have success against somewhat similar fighters, but for Canetti, he's less of a boxer, more of a kickboxer, and he loves to throw leg kicks with his back leg, and he will throw it to the body a lot too.
But that's the problem. I think if Canetti was more of a boxer, it would actually help him out in this, because he would be trying to get it into a range that Costa naturally struggles with. I think the fact that these guys are going to be happy kickboxing for a lot of this fight is going to favor Randy Costa being the bigger guy. I just think he's going to be able to land a lot more of his damaging shots. He's going to be able to find his sweet spot a lot faster in this matchup. If Guido can get past that early storm and show us a second or third gear to his game that we rarely do see, then maybe he is able to really wear on Randy Costa with some of his clinch and really work at the gas tank of him. But I think if you have two fighters who struggle with a lot of the same things, and one happens to be, what is it, 14 years younger, it's hard for me to not go with a much younger fighter.
The thing that I don't necessarily love about Costa, and I open it up talking about him saying this is a rebuild 3.0, he started off in the UFC with Lozon's Mixed Martial Arts, then he went to Sanford MMA. Now he's in American Combat Gym, and there's been kind of issues along the way. So it looks like from his Instagram, he's training a lot with his boxing and a lot of his Muay Thai. He's wearing the gloves and the Muay Thai trunks. We look at the odds for this matchup. Costa open to minus 260, minus 306. Canetti open plus 220, plus 240. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprised us there to you. Over under 82.5% Costa.
I think it'll be under, but he should be favored.
It's over 745 total votes, 89% Costa, 14% by decision, 80% by knockout. For the 11% that have Kennedy, 58% by knockout. Is the Kennedy fade on or still on for you?
It's just, neither one of these guys is going to become a champ. That's not a hot take, I hope. I just slightly favor Randy Costa. And even beating Guido Kennedy is not really going to prove that much to us. Like you said, the winner of this really does just cement their place in the UFC. And it doesn't really help them move up all that much. It just means you belong. So I think Randy Costa, even though he does have some gas tank issues, so does Guido Kennedy. So I don't expect either guy to really be able to pull apart from their opponent as this fight progresses. And I do ever so slightly favor the outside striking of Randy Costa. Again, I don't think this fight is then going to get him a rematch with Yanez and then a fight against Marab or anything like that. But I think it'll be good enough to beat a guy in Guido Kennedy.
I like the straight shots out of Randy Costa more than I like the looping shots out of Guido Kennedy. And Randy Costa has been caught by those type of shots in the past. Randy can get his legs compromised by kicks, which Guido throws out there. But I like that front kick up the middle. I like the head kicks from either side from Costa. I don't love the fact that, again, he's baby deer legs and never really plants on his shots. But his straight shots, I favor them to the big looping power shots out of Kennedy. And I think that Costa's overall skill set's a little bit more conducive to winning this matchup. So I have Randy Costa ever so slightly. But at minus 306, it feels a little bit silly considering what Kennedy was able to do his last time out. And if you like the fighter out of Argentina, you let us know down below in the comment section. If you like Costa like we do, also let us know down below in the comment section. We have some big time fights coming up on this card, including Mike Davis versus Slava Borshev. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Must be a blue moon coming up next weekend. We got a Mike Davis fight. He's going to be taking on Slava Claus, Slava Borshev. And for Mike Davis, if you don't know, now you know. I know Dana White likes to say that on his Instagram. But for me, I look at Mike Davis and he made a short notice debut on a week's notice to take on Gilbert Burns, you know, Durinho.
How did that end for him?
That fight took place about 3.5 years ago and he got ground out completely and submitted. And it just showed that, like, Beast in 25-8, there's levels! So for Davis, he takes some time off, and that's really been the story of his UFC tenure. He doesn't fight very often, and fights Thomas Gifford. And he beat the shit out of Thomas Gifford.
One of the hardest fights I've ever had to watch.
It was very, very difficult. So for Davis, he takes some more time off, he goes out and fights Mason Jones, and unbeknownst to me, Mike Davis was really banged up going into that fight, and he looked really, really good, and you can make an argument 29-28, 30-27. It takes two to tango. It was a fight of the night. But Davis really mixed it up in that fight, utilized his own offensive wrestling to beat Jones. And I know you might be sitting there going, well, Craig, Mason Jones isn't in the UFC anymore. It was a surprise to me as it was to you, like the Tapology votes always are. I was surprised they decided to let him go back.
It is wild, though. Just think, Mason Jones's whole UFC career has happened since the last time we saw Mike Davis in the octagon.
And I mean, if you look at it for Davis, this is kind of what I gained out of all of this. Because if you do consider it, that was a fight of the night. Injuries, setbacks, this and that. But I listened to an interview that he did with, and it's a mouthful, Combat Sports on Fanatics View. Shorten your name with James Lynch because he does interviews for
everybody.
Combat Sports on Fanatics View. And listen, his secondary thing is streaming and gaming. He likes to do that. That's cool. Good for Mike Davis. Good stream of income. Wasn't healthy in the Mason Jones fight. He had a torn labrum, rotator cuff, and bicep longhead on the right side.
It's like CC Sabathia in 2011.
Then he broke his right hand, or sorry,
left hand.
Left hand in the fight. So Mike Davis, he was suspended for 8 months medically. Then he got COVID. So he's been in and out of matchups. Then nobody seemed to want to fight him. He was booked in a fight against Jai Herbert, but he didn't want to go over to England for the fight. And then they couldn't find him anybody to fight in the States. This was originally supposed to be Mike Davis versus Uros Medic. And on September 14th, on 2 weeks' notice, Slava Borshev took the call. Both these guys with pro boxing experience. Both these guys strikers. Slava, a K1 champ, 2010-2011. Splitting hairs, but Davis went 3-0 in boxing. Borshev went 2-0. These guys are strikers to the nth degree. This should be a banger of a fight.
I'm very excited. I am as excited for this fight as I am any on the card. And it is because these are two of the better pure strikers in the division. And I think that's the type of fight we're going to get. It's going to cater to both guys' strengths and not their weaknesses. Now, with Mike Davis, he has some of the better boxing in the division. Just pure boxing. A type of fighter who can go to the body, go to the head. Throws in combinations, but can also throw single shots. And that's how you can kind of tell who is a really smart striker and who's just a guy who goes in there and brawls. Some people just throw set combinations. Yes, they have a lot of different combinations, but that's just how they're going to throw their strikes. If they throw the jab, automatically the two and the four coming right after it or whatever the set combination is. Some other fighters are just that single strike type. The fact that Mike Davis can switch between those two does show a very high level of fight IQ from Davis, but that's the thing. If you have hand injuries, but you're a wrestler, yes, I'm going to worry about it, but not as much, because I'm not as worried about the just force of your hands every single time you're doing anything that is just naturally conducive to your game plan. With Mike Davis and some of those hand injuries, I do worry about how that's going to affect his style. And we had another fighter not that long ago that we asked those exact same questions about, and it was Daniel Rodriguez. Now, Daniel Rodriguez didn't fight like he had hand problems, if that makes any sense. It didn't seem like it affected him all that much, but anytime you have a fighter that does heavily rely on their own boxing and their own power shots, and when they do have hand issues, it does really make me concerned, and especially the type of style that Mike Davis does throw in, because if he is going in there trying to, okay, sit down on a shot, be sound defensively, if he starts to run into those issues very early, and it does force him to fight in a manner like a wrestler, let's say Mike Davis goes in there and puts his wrestling shoes on, I'm not saying it won't work, because Slava does struggle with some of the takedown attempts, but still, if Davis fights in a manner that's not 100% Mike Davis, that's when some of those counters of Borishev are going to get through. He throws a great knee up the middle to meet a lot of wrestlers if they do start to go for takedown attempts, and I could see this being a fight where Mike Davis has a lot of success, maybe the leg kicks of Borishev start to add up, and they force Mike Davis to then become a bit more of a wrestler, a panic wrestler, to put it into Conor McGregor terms, and if that does happen, I think it's going to open up a lot of those counter shots of Borishev as this fight continues.
I think the wrestling's a little bit more of a natural part to Mike Davis's game, but as a kid, he was training at Customato's boxing gym in New York. So if you look at it for Davis, the craziest part about it is, you talk about boxers, and yeah, usually like they struggle, especially because you're holding the big gloves in front of your face, and sometimes boxing defense can either be a good thing in MMA, or it can get completely thrown out the window. Watch the way that Mike Davis strikes. He doesn't look like a boxer. He's in and out. He's light on his feet. His hands are also down at Julian Arosa levels. He does not hold his hands up high, doesn't have a Thai stance or a kickboxing stance or a boxing stance. It's very, very low and very wonky, and he can throw from odd angles, but typically he'll walk in, bring his hands up, and then throw his combinations back up, throw a kick, switch stances. He can really mix it in. We're talking about strikers to the nth degree, but when it comes to Davis and you touch on the hand injuries, look at Floyd Mayweather and Asakura over with Ryzen.
Oh, we can go even further.
Knocked him out.
Joe Calzaghe had hand issues his whole career. 49-0, one of the great Welsh boxers of all time. Pauly Malignaggi had hand problems. Like, a lot of fighters have hand problems. It's just, but that's why I bring up, though, if it's a pure wrestler, you don't worry as much, whereas if it is a boxer, you do worry about their
sense. To me, I almost gain more of an appreciation out of a guy who's right-hand dominant with that heavy right hand out of orthodox stance. And for Davis, torn labrum, torn rotator cuff, torn bicep long. You look at that, bringing in or implementing your wrestling against a guy like Mason Jones, having success with that in the takedowns with that arm, but still throwing power shots with your right hand, mixing in a jab with a broken left hand. What's this guy made out of? He's Beast Boy.
I don't know if you guys remember what, shout out Secret Base. It's a YouTube channel
that very makes good.
Really cool sports videos.
Great Dave Steve documentary.
But they made one about Penny Hardaway and how the Orlando Magic fell off after they made the finals with Penny and Shaq. You're right. Yes, I gained new appreciation for the toughness of Mike Davis. Penny Hardaway played in the playoffs on an injured knee, and he was never the same after because he competed with those injuries. You could look at Mike Davis in a similar aspect. When you compete with those injuries, it's just putting more and more wear onto something that's already screwed up. And with all this time off, we could see it. Like, that's the biggest problem with Mike Davis. If he was just a little bit more consistent, we would all have a much better idea of where he fits into this whole division, because his best skills are as good of, they're as good of an X factor as anybody else in the division has as an X factor. But the issue is, with all this time away and with all these injuries, what percentage of the old Mike Davis will he still be? And maybe this is the fight where he doesn't look great in this fight, but fights again in 4 months and looks really good afterwards. Or maybe he gets the win in this matchup, but we're not completely sold. And then the next time we see Mike Davis, he makes a bit more of an improvement. I just think there's a lot of question marks around this fight.
Both strikers, both very different. For Borishev, training at a Team Alpha Male, takedown defense, it's going to get better. It's going to get better. It was okay against Dakota Bush until Bush couldn't finally get the takedown. Borishev finished him. Against Mark Jacasey, I mean, Mark Giacchese is the best.
Like Bo Nickel.
Mark Giacchese is George St. Pierre 2.0, whereas I was a striker, I was a karate guy, to now I'm just a wrestler. And he looked very, very good in that fight. And Borshev had no response to any of it. But in some of his fights, all of them except for the fight against Mark Giacchese, he has Chumbawamba grappling. He gets knocked down, he gets right back up again. So good stuff for Borshev, but you look at it, the left hook to the body is one of his best shots. He's a southpaw, so his lead right hook is one of his better shots as well. And he utilizes kicks incredibly well. So very diverse guys, very, very fun matchup stylistically. Who's going to look the fresher guy? I know Slava Borshev's a great translator on Dana White's Contender Series. I can't say the same.
Cool.
Can't say the same thing for Mike Davis.
Is this a poor man's version of Brad Riddell versus Rafael Fiziev?
I mean, I can get up for both of them, and I don't understand how either of these guys makes lightweight.
That's a very good point, because they both are very big. But for Borshev, he does throw a little bit, like a few more kicks. He's a bit more like Fiziev, whereas Riddell, a little bit more boxing heavy, reminds me a bit of Mike Davis. That's all. Just draw parallels to another fight.
Well, we look at the odds in this one. Davis open minus 250, minus 184 right now in best fight odds. For Slava Claus, open plus 210, plus 157. I think that's... I get knocked down by Giacchese. I got to get back up again. Now people are kind of coming back after that Giacchese loss. We look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over-under because both guys are pretty well fan favorites and favorites of the channel with Fight Night Picks. I'll say over-under 70% Davis.
Here's the thing.
It was based on the odds.
For me, I think Mike Davis is going to win over 70%, but I'm going to say that they're lower, I think.
That's slightly over. So 591 total votes, 73% Davis, 65% by decision, 28% by knockout. For the 27% that have Borshev, 31% by decision, 60% by knockout. Matt, again, this was supposed to be Mike Davis or Oros Medic 2 weeks ago. Borshev in, so he gets 2 weeks to get ready for it. I don't know if I look too far into that because Davis is getting ready for
very similar fighter, I'd say, honestly.
Medic used to like the big takedown over with Alaska FC, but he would kind of strike a little wild. The thing that I liked out of Mike Davis that I did hear, though, big frame, very, very translucent skin like our own, does Vyacheslav Borshev and Uros Medic have. So we'll save that. But when I did listen to Mike Davis when he was talking to James Lynch, it was, I don't look into tape at all. I don't want to know how good this guy is because if all I do is watch his tape and his highlights, I'm just going to think I can't beat this guy. He's so good. I'm not going to be able to get the win. So I don't really see it as a huge change for Davis going to Borshev. For Borshev on short notice against Davis, oh, well, I get a striker. I wonder if he will kind of underestimate the takedown abilities of Davis, which is a credible part to his game.
I think Borshev's going to come in trying to get a first-round knockout. And normally, it's tough to pick a fighter who has that type of a game plan. But on short notice, against a guy Mike Davis, who, again, has big power, but also has the ability to have big power late in a fight as well. He's not the type of fighter who really needs to go out there and knock you out in the first round to be able to get a stoppage. Look at the Thomas Gifford fight. He just beats him up for 14 and a half minutes and then stops him at the end. That's a really hard fight to watch. I'm not joking at all. But I think Slava Borshev has a much better chance than a lot of people are giving him credit for, especially the Tapology voters, I will say, because I think this is going to end via knockout one way or another, and I think his opportunities to get a knockout are going to be very high in this fight, because Davis is going to go in there to strike with him, at least initially. I can see that if things start going wrong for him on the feet, let's say Borshev is starting to land that left hook to the body, maybe some of those leg kicks are getting to Davis, then maybe Mike Davis puts on the wrestling shoes, and for that reason, and his ability to have two tones to his game, I like Mike Davis in this matchup, but I think Borshev is an extremely dangerous fighter in a fight like this, where stylistically you're going to give him what he does best. You're going to go in there to strike with him, and he does have legitimate power and very unorthodox striking ability. So again, I think this is a very difficult fight to predict just because of the power of Borshev, but I think Davis has a more structurally sound game.
To me, with Borshev, I've had issues since I watched the Kenley St. Louis fight where he gets dropped and then he gets back up and they strike a little bit more and he gets the win. I've had issues with the takedown defense. I just maybe haven't really been on the side of Borshev through Dana White's Contender Series in the UFC, and not necessarily in this matchup either, because I do like the well-roundedness of Davis in a matchup like this. Both guys kickboxing, both guys boxing experience. Mike Davis tends to put those wrestling shoes on. You look at his main training partner, who in his last Instagram post weighed 210 pounds, Adolfo Vieira, to get ready. You never know, but I do like that X factor for Mike Davis. This should be an amazing fight, a fight of the night. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Some big time fights on this card. In the co-main event, Rude Boy Randy Brown taking on Masaran Duba. I was born in the 70s, Francisco Trinaldo. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
2 weeks ago in the co-main event of UFC Fight Night, Sandhagen versus Song, we were supposed to be getting Giga Chikadze and Sadiq Yusuf. Chikadze out and Sadiq Yusuf is just left. Doesn't have a fight.
What a fight that would have been, though.
It would have been great. And then ultimately, we get two division champ out of Cage Titans and FAC. Shameless Don Sheamus. Matt, do you think he walks into every single room going, I'm Sheamus? Sheamus is a man can be. Do you think he's a big Garth fan?
I don't think he is. You'd, I hope not.
Well, I mean, listen, Garth Brooks, let's get physical on stage. But when it does come to this matchup, for Super Sadiq Yusuf, you know him from Contender Series. He got that big time win over Mike Davis. He was actually more than a 2-1 underdog in that matchup. Craziest thing that people might not know about Yusuf, he's been a favorite in every single UFC fight that he's had. And he really does have a decent level of competition. It's kind of the build that you like to see the UFC go on. He gets that win over Mike Davis on Contender Series.
He fought his way up in a great way.
And then he fights Suman Mokhtarian, and he's a giant favorite in that one. And then he fights, who else? Shaymon Moraes, Gabriel Benitez, Andre Feely, loses to Arnold Allen, beats Alex Caceres. It really was a nice burn for Yusuf out of Lloyd Irvin Martial Arts. And for Yusuf, the one knock on him in his UFC career is that he can get knocked in the first round. You look at the Gabriel Benitez fight, you look at the fight against Arnold Allen, he's had to rally. He's shown that he can rally, but he's had to rally in those fights.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. That's the thing about Sadiq Yusuf. You look at him and you see the power punching that he's able to display. You see the physicality to his game, and you assume that there isn't much of a lasting ability because of it. You couldn't be more wrong, though, and that is the thing about Yusuf. He can get off to a slower start. He almost fights in that Forrest Griffin kind of way, where the fight doesn't start until he gets cracked, and then the fight begins at that point, because Yusuf does, he can carry his power very late. He has an odd wrestling game because, let's be honest, he doesn't necessarily have a wrestling base like a Michael Chandler or Josh Emmett or even an Alex Munoz, for instance, but he isn't the worst MMA wrestler. Like, he can go out and get his own offensive takedown. He was able to do it against Andre Feely in their matchup, and I think we all understand that, okay, Feely might not be the greatest wrestler of all time or grappler, but if you go out there and have success in that department against a guy like Feely, when we think of you as a striker, it's just a really nice thing to have in your game and in your back pocket to be able to go to when things get dicey on the feet. But the thing about Sadiq Yusuf is he has so much power and really good technique that things rarely do get dicey for him on the feet. But like you said, the people who have been able to have success with him are sort of the longer, rangier strikers in this division. The Gabriel Benitez fight was a really important one for Sadiq Yusuf. Benitez at that point was still thought of as maybe not a ranked fighter by any means, but just one of those dangerous, unranked guys who can give anybody a tough fight. Just a classic I can play spoiler type of a fighter. And Gabriel Benitez made Sadiq come to him. He didn't initiate a lot of the exchanges. And when Yusuf did drop his hands to try to throw one of those big hooks, Benitez was able to catch him on that half beat, put him down. But from that point forward, Sadiq Yusuf kept his hands up. And that was really the key. Yusuf does seem to be one of those fighters who, if he makes a mistake early, he will learn from some of those previous mistakes. And he can build as the fight progresses.
Well, I mean, on the dicey counter, we've got dicey. But you talk about his wrestling, and he did actually struggle in the wrestling department. I mean, you brought it up. He took Andre Feely down. Andre Feely took him down three times.
Feely took down Dennis Bermudez.
Caceres took down Yusuf. Arnold Allen took Yusuf down a couple of times. So he has been susceptible to getting taken down. And again, we mentioned it. He has been a favorite in his UFC fights. Minus 600 against Mokhtarian. 145, 280, minus 145, minus 135 against Allen. And minus 270 against Alex Caceres' last time out. But if you do consider it, he's actually technically 10th all time in featherweight history in significant strike differential.
Really?
At a 1.43 clip. It's 5.22 to 6.36.
Still so high numbers.
Really high output. He gets hit more than the UFC average, but it is what it is. So let's focus in on the man who is billed out of Boston, Massachusetts, trains at a Citadel Martial Arts and Fitness, but for this camp, switching it up, Glory MMA and Fitness. I think you saw James Krause in his corner, not so far away. He was on Dana White's Looking for a Fight, was the guy who, I mean, when I look at Don Sheamus, all I think of is, but I've never been in love like this! Oh, it's out of my hands! I'm Sheamus!
I'm so sorry if you have headphones on right now.
Do you think he goes to, like, the stadium shows? Do you think he traveled to Ireland to go see Garth Brooks?
I hope not.
Hashtag Mr.
Because if he's that big of a fan, then it's going to be he want to see him lose.
I tell people, like, we laugh, we joke. I just sang Garth Brooks twice.
Garth Brooks so much.
I am not a Garth Brooks fan at all. And when I tell people that I like country music and I don't like Garth Brooks, they lose their minds. They don't understand. But for Don Sheamus, When you go back and you watch his tape, boy, is it ever fun.
That's the thing. A guy making his UFC debut who fights in the style of Don Sheamus is either going to have the best chance to win or the worst chance to win. And when we did the initial, like, preview of the card in the show opening, I had mentioned that this fight does kind of remind me of Josh Emmett when he'd taken on Ricardo Lamas. And no, Josh Emmett wasn't making his UFC debut in that fight, but he was making his divisional debut at 145 pounds, and nobody thought Josh Emmett had a snowball's chance in hell to win that fight. But what was he able to do? He went in there, threw some hammers, and one of those was able to land against Ricardo Lamas, a guy who traditionally has been a bit of a slow starter in the past. So for Don Sheamus, who does throw with everything behind his shots, we'll throw it in combinations. We'll throw some up the middle attacks too, some of those things that we have seen Yusuf struggle with in the past. I could see this being a fight where Sheamus is able to go in there, get that 40-second stoppage a la Alexander Hernandez. Benil Dariush is another one that comes to mind. Like, these have happened before in the past.
You look at these two guys and physically, they're very much the same. Sadiq Yusuf, smaller featherweight in terms of his height. Don Sheamus, same thing. Both guys yoked up. Both guys have some of the biggest legs you're ever going to see in this division. And for both of them, it helps them throw their power shots. They can plant and throw. And when you look at Don Sheamus, 5-0-1 as an amateur, his lone draw was his last amateur fight against Chris Moutinho, who's in the UFC. 12-3 as a pro. And you look at it, he's on a 5-fight win streak. He's finished plenty. I threw the tweet out there, and I'll throw it up there on screen. I thought it was a layup. Chris Lencioni was going to beat him on Looking for a Fight, and Chris Lencioni was going to end up on Contender Series or the UFC. That was a really weird fight, because Chris Lencioni looked like he showed up to win, but he didn't show up till the third round to win that fight. Like, first round, he looked like he was playing touch. Like, he did not
start it very late.
He didn't look comfortable. It was a weird showing from Lencioni. So, you look at it for Sheamus, not a good level of competition, but that's the weird thing. So
we all know who he beat.
Just look at this 5-fight win streak. He beats 3-3 Quentin Weiland. This is in the middle, or sorry, the end of 2021. On short notice, he fights Chris Lencioni and he beats him.
Sorry, can I pretend to be the CEO for Cage Titans 52 next?
Oh, so you're...
Hey, Don, do you want to win?
Hold on. So you're Calvin Cater?
Yeah, can I be Calvin Cater for a moment? Hey, Don. You know Jay Ellis? He's 16-103. Do you want to fight him?
At the time.
104 after that fight.
So if anybody's never seen a Jay Ellis fight, I've been in the room for one of them when he took on Josh Harvey.
It's like seeing a unicorn.
No, well, there's so many of them. There's a lot of unicorns then. But the craziest part about it is, so again, 3-3 Quentin Weiland, then he beat 7-2 Chris Lencioni. That holds a ton of water. And he beat him round one, round two. They gave 30-27s were out there, but I thought Lencioni won the third round. He looked pretty good in that round. Jay Ellis does his typical Jay Ellis thing. Runs out of the cage, runs across the cage, big burst, and then he gets finished really easily. So that's a predictable win. Now, Jay Ellis went 1-1 against Gerald Meerschaert, so there is that. Then, Don Sheamus takes on Cody Pfister. Well, Cody Pfister fought 4 times in the UFC and fought on The Ultimate Fighter. Hadn't fought in over a year. Sheamus does his typical, and if you've never seen Don Sheamus fight, here it is. This guy goes balls to the wall and brawls for as long as the fight goes on. And he'll get a takedown, and he's very much submission, ground and pound over position. He will jump to submissions that aren't even there.
Kind of undisciplined.
Just to see if he can get them. But Don Sheamus is very much, if you were like 17 and you just found out what a king-size Red Bull was, that's how Don Sheamus fights. It's all over the place and it doesn't make any sense. He beats Cody Pfister because he goes balls to the wall, finishes him on the mat. Then he fights 9-7 Bryce Pico. So you go from fighting Cody Pfister and winning a title at lightweight to then fighting Bryce Pico with Cage Titans for the featherweight strap. 9-7 Bryce Pico. The fight starts off, I'm going to brawl. And then Bryce Pico goes, I'm going to land a straight shot. And it completely wobbles Don Sheamus. Don turns into a wrestler. Then he ends up finishing Bryce Pico. But it is a fan-friendly style. I don't know if it's conducive to good cardio and winning in the UFC, but it's a hell of a lot of fun to watch.
I thought Sadiq Yusuf had a really good chance to beat Giga Chikadze. I'm not going to lie. I know Giga looked really good all the way up until he fought Calvin Kattar, but I thought that was just a good stylistic matchup for Sadiq Yusuf. I don't think Sadiq Yusuf's going to lose to Don Sheamus if I thought he had a chance to beat Giga Chikadze. I'm sorry.
The odds in this one, Yusuf open -550, -967 for Sheamus. Like, that's too rich for my blood. Sheamus open +420. And now +606. Dang, we have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. I doubt they're close. I'm going to say over under 95%.
I'll say over. And here's the last thing, too. Sadiq is the younger fighter between these two. Like, he is a young fighter for where he is in the UFC.
Damn it. 622 total votes, 94% Yusuf, 30% by decision, 64% by knockout for the 6% that have Sheamus, 62% by knockout. Matt, you and me going fishing in the dark was a cover that Garth did from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. Sheamus has a good opportunity early in the fight because I don't like how Sadiq gets knocked and has to find his way into some of these fights. So if you like Don Sheamus and you like him by knockout, you probably like him in the first round. I like Yusuf to win, but the odds are just silly.
The odds are, okay, I agree with the odds. They're just ridiculous. That's all it is. Like, MMA is a dumb sport where anybody can win at any point just because the gloves are so small and everyone's a knockout artist basically because of it. But Sadiq Yusuf is one of the best fighters in this division. He lost a decision to Arnold Allen, who just knocked out Dan Hooker in like 2 minutes. So I do think Sadiq Yusuf is very belonging in these rankings. I think he's going to be in the top 15 for a very long time. And I think he's a tough matchup for a lot of fighters in these rankings. So other than an Alexander Hernandez, Benil Dariush type of a knockout, I don't see Yusuf losing this.
Both of us going with Super Sadiq Yusuf to get the win. It is the overall wave that Yusuf brings into a fight like this where I can see him getting it done, where Sheamus can get a little bit reckless, and maybe they should change that nickname from Reckless Shameless. We'll see what happens. Les, Matt, big time fights on this card. If you missed it, Mike Davis taking on Slava Borshev in the co-main event. Randy Brown taking on Francisco Trinaldo in the main event. Mackenzie Dern, Yan Zhao Nan. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say, let's get into it. In the bantamweight division, we have a matchup like it was 1993, Ric Flair versus Mr. Perfect, or WrestleMania number 7 when Macho Man Randy Savage was taking on the Ultimate Warrior. And listen, it's a loser-go-home match. We have Haunie Barcelos taking on Trevin Jones. And I say that because Haunie Barcelos, and picture this, and I'm not going to make like a reference to, what's that band, what's that rap group?
Well, that narrows it down.
Picture this. I'm a bag of dicks. Put me to your lips.
Run the Jewels.
Run the Jewels. There we go. Well, picture this. Haunie Barcelos was the underground champion before Sean O'Malley coined the term. I mean, Haunie was that guy for a very long time. And if you don't believe me, go watch Haunie Barcelos fights where he's winning. He was amazing. He can throw with tons of power. He has good offensive wrestling, good defensive wrestling, insane jiu-jitsu. He's a jiu-jitsu black belt. He's a freestyle wrestling champ. His dad wrote the book before he did any of this stuff. If MMA was around, Haunie Barcelos' dad probably would have won a belt as well because he was a freestyle wrestling champ in the 90s. He's a 7th degree Coral black belt in jiu-jitsu is his dad. And that is his main coach and training partner. But if you look at it for Haunie, training a lot with Davi Hamosh for this matchup against Trevin Jones, pretty good background to have because for Jones, he's also a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt in his own right. He's moved his camp since he's joined the UFC to Drysdale BJJ. Also trains out of Extreme Couture. All of this in Vegas. But when I look at this matchup, Matt, Haunie used to be the RFA champ. I used to think incredibly highly of him. I think he's aged himself out because he's between 35 and 36. It was just the inactivity. That really was the issue. But he was super competitive against guys that he should have beat. He was beating them. He was putting on fight of the nights. He's got three of them. Kurt Hollibaugh, Timur Valiyev, and the other one was, Matt, can you think of who it was?
All the times to pass it off.
It was Khalid Taha. That was the other one. And he just was able to do so much. But now, if you look at his last two fights, Timur Valiyev fight. Came out slow in the first round, dropped him twice in the second round. Third round, chintzy. You could have made an argument that it was a draw. But his last time out for Barcelos, he was supposed to take on Trevin Jones. And that fight falls out. Victor Henry comes in on short notice. They move it back a week because Barcelos got COVID. They fight. And Victor Henry's a damn good fighter. He beat Kyler Phillips at one point. I think highly of Victor Henry.
He put a pace on Haunie. But
Victor Henry is a decent striker. He's primarily a grappler. He looked amazing at striking against Barcelos, and Barcelos looked slow, so maybe it was COVID or maybe it was age. But Matt, I thought highly of Haunie Barcelos for so long, and it's hard for that kind of, I guess, vision to cloud my judgment on a prediction like this. But it's just kind of weird to see him in the last two fights kind of falter.
It is odd that both these fighters do have two distinct versions to their games. When Trevin Jones is on, he is a power puncher with great wrestling. He's going to use his wrestling to negate yours and really uses incredible power punching to his benefit on the feet. But the problem is, that's the A version of Jones, let's say. The B version is he doesn't do anything. That's really the concerning thing about Trevin Jones. If he's not fighting at his peak capacity, he's on the back foot a lot, he's waiting for his opponent, and he's just trying to land that one big counter shot off of the actions that his opponents bring to him. Whereas with Hauny Barcelos, there's the prime version of Hauny, which is that well-rounded fighter you bring up who can hurt you on the feet, submit you on the mat. But this older version that we've seen of Hauny, he still fights in the same manner that he used to, but now it's almost like he ran a marathon before he got to the cage. Like, there is just that little bit of explosiveness that is lacking from his game, and it almost seems like that little bit of explosion was what made him so unique to begin with, because normally when you deal with a well-rounded athlete, they don't really have that fast twitch to their game too, but Hauny did have that upon his initial run, and we just haven't seen it, like you said.
And we don't normally talk about the stats, but I'll throw it up there. That's that graphic from UFC stats. Look at the differences between the striking of these two guys, and it's a small sample size for Trevin Jones. He beat Timur Valiev, so for all you MMA math fans, he beat Valiev, and Barcelos lost to Valiev, so therefore Trevin Jones wins this fight. Test positive for the weed.
I don't care about that.
Well, then it doesn't matter anymore in Vegas, but they still have it as a no contest on his record. How about we change that? But he did get a performance bonus in that matchup. He beats Valiev, and he looked really good against Mario Bautista, who's a very good fighter.
Exactly. And that age, or that win age is extremely well, because Bautista's looked good as of late.
But then Jones goes out and fights Sadyu Kokrakmanov, who's a good offensive wrestler and throws good volume with power, like Barcelos does. And Trevin Jones looks flat, which Trevin Jones, it's got to be said, coming into the UFC, I didn't have high hopes. I thought he had kind of, not lazy grappling, but he'd wait for his opponent, let them take him down, really take his time to get his positions. He'd throw really good counters, and he'd sit down on his shots when you're coming in, but a low-volume striker. And in the UFC, that's what I've seen in his last two fights. He did that against Sadyu Kokrakmanov. He showed up. Weigh-ins were tough. And he looked slow as the fight wore on.
Bashra kicked him about 400 times.
And Javid Bashra's a really good fighter, and I get that. But also, Trevin Jones stayed on his back foot, didn't throw any volume, and he went for takedowns. He went for the most labored, like, across cage, double, like, single leg, sorry. He was going ankle pick on one of them, got pushed right off, and then he had no answer, and the cardio didn't look
and
good.
That's the problem with Jones. Again, if plan A isn't working, I'm not all that confident in playing B, C, or D, or even if there is that level or those levels to his game. Again, I think the best version of Trevin Jones could go out there, defend a lot of the takedowns from Hauny, be smart enough defensively on the feet to make it so that Barcelos isn't able to land his own power shots, and then if Jones is able to land a shot on Barcelos, I don't think there's an argument Trevin Jones is the much more heavy-handed between these two, but I just don't know how many situations he's going to be able to put himself into to actually land that one big shot, because if he is just waiting for Barcelos, especially on the back foot like we have seen his last two fights, I think he's going to struggle with a lot of the takedowns too of Hauny. Even though Trevin Jones is a good wrestler, again, wrestling is a big part of his game, I just think that if he is in that weird game where it's okay, I'm thinking a lot, I'm waiting for what Hauny's going to be doing, I just don't know how Trevin Jones is going to be able to sustain enough offense to be able to win rounds in this matchup.
Well, to me, from Jones, he's a southpaw striker, and he's very much like long range, kind of old timey. He's heavy on his lead leg. Hauny Barcelos has great leg kicks, and it's a big part of his game, and I haven't seen Jones adapt to switching over to orthodox either.
I will say this though, Barcelos and the lack of speed that he has shown his last few fights is going to make him susceptible to getting caught by a counter.
Showed it in the fight against Valiev, dropped him twice in the second round. Third
that
round,
was the
I
last
thought he
version
won.
Of him we saw though.
But for Barcelos, didn't look great against Victor Henry, and out of 2,392 total Tapology votes, 6% had Victor Henry, so it was a giant
credible
upset his last time out. Which version do we get? It's really the question for both of these guys. In terms of the odds, Barcelos open a minus 280 favorite. He's a minus 225 for Jones. Open plus 240, plus 180. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us, there to you. I'm going to say over under 80% Barcelos.
The odds would suggest that, so I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. It's over. 723 total votes, 86% Barcelos, 80% by decision. For the 14% that have Jones, 48% by knockout. I still think Barcelos has enough in the tank. He throws so much more volume traditionally than Jones, and even in his last two fights, he still threw really good volume against Henry and against Valiev. It was just, he didn't have enough volume to match Victor Henry. Henry was a fresher fighter and looked much better in that one, and he was able to drop Timur Valiev twice in the second round, which, according to Valiev's last couple of fights, apparently it's a little easier
exactly,
to do than it used to be.
Say.
And for Trevin Jones, he was able to do it too. But for Jones, it's the lack of volume. It's the lack of offense. It's the fact that he hasn't been able to get the takedowns in these last couple of fights, where Barcelos, if anything, has such a good wrestling pedigree, takedown defense, and jiu-jitsu in his own right. I have Barcelos, but the thing that holds me back a little bit is the fact that he just has lost a little bit of a step in his last two fights that concerns me, but I still like Barcelos in this fight.
I like Barcelos in this fight, but again, if the best version of Trevin Jones shows up and the Hounie who showed up against Victor Henry shows up, I think Trevin Jones could easily knock him out because that's the kind of power that he does possess in his hands. And if Hounie, again, doesn't really have that step to help him get out of range, I could see him looking really good, landing with a lot of volume. But in the middle of one of his combinations, one of the big counters of Trevin Jones could come out of nowhere and really hurt him. But again, I do think Barcelos has the more well-rounded game, and that's why I predict him. I'm just surprised to see him be this much of a favorite, especially coming off his last two performances. I know Jones himself hasn't looked great as of late either. I'm just a little bit surprised to see Barcelos being almost a 3-1 favorite.
Both of us going with Laerte Barcelos' son, Hounie, to get the win. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this matchup. Co-main event. Come a rude boy, can you get it up? Taking on Masaran Duba, it's Randy Brown and Francisco Trinaldo in the main event. Mackenzie Dern taking on Yan Xiao Nan. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it.
Sexy Mexi. Willie Cat.
So Sexy Mexi versus Willie Cat. We have John Castaneda taking on Daniel Santos. Matt, this is the bantamweight fight that you didn't know you needed, but this is a fight where I go, what the fuck are they doing matching these two guys up?
Why is it so high up on the card too?
So again, I said this earlier on in the card because we had a couple of fighters that were incredibly low ranked on Tapology, matching off, squaring off in UFC. Like, we're talking below regional level fighters that compete at lightweight. For this fight, you go into Tapology and they have John Castaneda ranked as the 34th bantamweight, taking on Daniel Santos, who's ranked 107th. And when you just focus on the fact that John Castaneda finished Eddie Wineland in his second to last fight. Okay, you can say, well, Eddie Wineland, he's past it. He's not WEC champ anymore. So what? Who cares? Okay, well, John Castaneda went out and then finished Miles Jones. And he didn't just submit him. He dropped him and submitted him in the third round. Castaneda looked very, very good in that matchup. He's only lost to Nathaniel Wood in the UFC. He lost the fight to Jose Aldo all day by split decision over with Combate. He's had big fights in other organizations in very high level situations. That's where that Sexy Mexi sound drop came from. And for Castaneda, his background is wrestling. He comes out of the University of Minnesota, Mankato, which is a giant hockey school, like a huge hockey school. If you're looking for University of Minnesota, maybe you're Duluth, maybe you're Mankato, but sometimes you come out as a wrestler like John Castaneda, who still trains there at the Academy MN, which is awesome to see. Castaneda is very well-rounded. He's a nice southpaw. He'll bait you into his striking. He's got good kicks. He's got really good boxing combination. And the thing that I like, he can bait you in coming this way, but it'll hurt you going this way. He goes side to side very well. For Willie Cat, this guy is a wild man. He does spinning attacks. He's very, very fun, but he will walk you down in a high tie stance. He comes out of Shoot the Box Diego Lima with Alan Nascimento, Thomas Almeida, Charles Oliveira, and the like. But for Willie Cat, I look at it as level competition was not bad coming into the UFC, but why did you sign a guy who hadn't fought like 2 years into his UFC debut? Not. He fights Julio Arce, and I know there's 29, 28s out there and whatever, but guys, like, focus in on this. Daniel Willie Cat landed 49 of 229 significant strikes for a 21% clip to the 127 of 265 for Julio Arce. He had no answers. Now, was he outmatched in the matchmaking?
100%.
100%. But why the fuck are we doing this again?
Yeah, I was about to ask that too. Daniel Da Silva's in the same fight he was just in.
I like him.
And he's always going to have fun fights. And that's the thing about guys like these. Are they ever going to get into the rankings and fight people like Dominic Cruz and Chito Vera? Probably not. Well, okay, Castaneda might be able to get up to there. But still, for Daniel Santos, is it going to be the most memorable of runs? Probably not. But still, the fights themselves are going to be entertaining. And like you said, his fighting style is conducive to getting bonuses and being in those bonus winning type of fights, whether he wins or loses, because he does have that very high tie style, but he is kind of reckless with his own striking, even though he can be technical with it. I just look at his game and I compare it to John Castaneda's. Sexy Maxi is so much more well-rounded to where you would mention his game is a lot of wrestling, but you wouldn't necessarily know that depending on which fight you watch. He can go out there and just strike. He does have a good submission ability. He does have good cardio, and he can take a shot too. Now, I do worry a little bit about some of his striking defense if he is able to fight some more of those upper echelon fighters, and maybe the striking style of Daniel Santos is just enough of a wrinkle that it will give Castaneda issues on the feet. I just think that Castaneda's plan B is always going to be there if he does need it. If he is having trouble on the feet, I think he is going to be able to put on the wrestling shoes and have enough success in this matchup to dominate purely with his grappling, and I don't even think we're going to need to see that side of his game necessarily.
Santos was said to have had decent takedown defense outside of the UFC. Watching the fights, I didn't think it was the greatest. I thought his striking defense was pretty good because he spins a lot, and he tends to have good cardio for a guy that expends a lot of energy when he does stuff like that. For Castaneda, I'm surprised he's not fighting like Casey Kenney this weekend.
Yeah, instead that would have been a good
instead
matchup.
Instead of Daniel Santos.
It is weird that they're rewarding Daniel Santos with this type of matchup when he is coming off a loss and now he's the third highest fight on the card.
It's really weird. Okay, you're going to wonder, well, guys, why are you saying all this about Daniel Santos? Okay, I'll sell you a different package. Daniel Santos, very good striker, has a lot of power, has submission abilities when it gets to the mat, can take on wrestlers and then submit them on the ground. I mean,
how high level are they?
It can happen. So it is an oddball pairing. It is an oddball matchup. I've said a lot of negative things and I can say a lot of positive things.
It just feels like a showcase fight for Castaneda, for being honest. They're putting him this high up on the card. They're giving him a favorable matchup. Like, it does feel like the UFC is trying to build a star here with the Sexy Maxi.
Castaneda open -150. He's -215 right now. Santos open +130, +175. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say over under 85% Castaneda.
I'll say slightly under, but he'll be the favorite. Over, wow.
699 total votes, 90% Castaneda, 71% by decision. For the 10% that have Santos, 57% by decision. If Daniel Santos wins, he finishes John Castaneda.
I would agree.
He knocks him out when Castaneda drops his hands when he moves backwards. That's a way to do it. Or he submits him when Castaneda takes him down. That's pretty much all I can tell you. For Daniel Santos, I was high enough on him coming into the UFC. Myself and everybody in the MMA community thought that Santos was going to have like a fight of the night against Julio Arce. And instead, he threw super low volume numbers from the outside. And every time Arce went in and out, he was able to land. If Arce can do that, and I think Arce is a very good boxer and striker, then I think Castaneda can do it as well. I need to see it from Daniel Santos. He comes from a perfect gym to get him ready for a matchup like this. But man, I haven't done a video with Fight Night Picks, I don't think, where I've been so one-sided in the analysis.
Listen, if Daniel Santos is able to get the win this weekend, it is a massive boost in his career. It's going to save him like 3 years of time, basically, to get him that much in the forefront of MMA fans' minds. I just think for Castaneda, this is a pretty good stylistic matchup for him. I like his wrestling in this. I even think if he wants to decide to strike for the entirety of it, his volume numbers are good enough, and he is sound enough defensively to where if he doesn't pull out on a weird angle and eat a big power shot, I think he's got this one in the bag.
We do this thing as MMA fans, media, the people that cover these fights, and we let one loss define a person, and we let the pendulum swing way too far. But for Daniel Santos, the last time he won a fight was almost 3 years ago against Nazembek Juzanov, who was 7-1 at the time. He armbarred him back with Brave. It's been a long time. I have to see it. I don't want to let the pendulum swing too far with that one loss to Julio Arce, but I've seen a lot more recently out of John Castaneda, who at least put on a competitive fight against Nathaniel Wood, who's now... he's lighting the world on fire at 145. So both of us going with John Castaneda, the Sexy Mexi, get the win. If you have Willy Cat, which is a part of the a character on the Portuguese version of Thundercat, you let us know. Both of us with Castaneda, Randy Brown, Masaron Duba in the co-main event, Dern taking on Yan Xiaonan in the main event. You're not going to want to miss any of it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
This weekend, this is the third installment of guys that were born in the 70s on this card. Masaron Duba, Francisco Trinaldo taking on Rude Boy Randy Brown. And just when you think that the cat couldn't come back, well, the cat came back. And for Francisco Trinaldo, 4-1 in his last five fights. And he was a guy that it was just too difficult to make the lightweight limit anymore. In the UFC, you'd think, oh, what's Francisco Trinaldo's record? Is he like 10-3? Now he's 18-7 in the UFC since Wild. He debuted years ago. And then you would have thought, well, he's taken on a much younger, rangier, longer strikers last time out and Danny Roberts, hot chocolate. And I would have picked Danny Roberts to win. And I did. And you would have picked Danny Roberts to win. And you did. And the scores for that fight, 30-27, 30-26, 29-28. Francisco Trinaldo just keeps it up. And it's really weird to say that he's in a fight against Randy Brown. And it's going to be close and competitive in 2022.
Is it though? This is the problem that I have with this matchup. This is as far as you can go without doing a disservice to Massa Randuba, I think. Because here's the thing, you're right. He has been on a really good run at this stage of his career, and he has been able to really focus on the strengths of his game and really let them speak for himself. Because
power jab, overhand right.
Overhand left, southpaw.
Vice versa.
But that's the thing about Trinaldo. He knows what he's good at, and he really does stick to those parts of his game. Throws a good hook kick, too, from his right leg. He's very unorthodox with some of his kicking techniques in the feet. But he is a very high-sprung striker. And it is almost like seeing a catapult. Like, you just get all that tension built up, and then Trinaldo throws one of those really big techniques. And he does carry his power, even at the age of 44. It is kind of incredible to see a welterweight slash lightweight. Some people do it at this stage of his career, but for Trinaldo, I think the holes are still there in his game to where a fighter who is very young and in his prime and looking to make his run towards the rankings in Randy Brown is going to be able to have more than enough success against a guy like Trinaldo, because Brown, the weaknesses in his game do overlap with a lot of the strengths that Trinaldo brings into the cage. Like I said, Trinaldo's a very good kicker. He goes to the leg, goes to the body with those kicks. He is rangy with his footwork, but at a certain point, the footwork does start to slow down. It's not that he has bad cardio for how old he is whatsoever, because it is kind of incredible to see Trinaldo have this type of lasting power in his MMA career, but his feet are very active in the first round of a fight, and they're still fairly active, I'll say, in the second round of the fight, but they do start to slow down as the fight continues. And in this fight, I look at it a lot like I looked at the Cowboy Oliveira fight for Randy Brown. You're dealing with a striker who, on the feet, yes, they're rangy, they can throw kicks, and they can make it difficult with their boxing, but for the most part, they don't really have a plan B or a plan C after that, and I don't know if Trinaldo can eat the power shots that Randy Brown's gonna be able to bring into the cage.
If you're a fighter that backs up and doesn't move side to side, Francisco Trinaldo can beat you every single time all damn night.
And can
night.
Look good while he does it.
And he can kind of have a hard time cutting the cage against certain opponents that are speedy on the outside, but against Danny Roberts, he was able to get it done. The fight against Muslim Salikov, they both kind of met in the middle and kept the pressure going. But you look at these last four fights, and we'll focus in on it. John McDessie, about 2.5 years ago, beats him, knocks out Jai Herbert, where Herb Dean wanted to see more, beats Dwight Grant by split decision.
Awful fight.
Very close fight, wasn't great. And then the win over Danny Roberts. For Rude Boy Randy Brown, he was found on a Ring of Combat show, which was a Dana White's Looking for a Fight special back when Nick the Tooth was a thing. And if that I took weird. The crown off my tooth, I could do it again, which we almost had a week like that with Fight Night Picks until I get it put back on. But for Randy Brown, you look at it, in the UFC, it's been more good than bad out of the losses. The Nico,
a very high level of competition.
The Nico Price fight, definitely one that sticks out. The thing that you do kind of, or will trouble you, Randy Brown's had his chin checked quite a bit. He had a great first and second round against Chaos Williams. He had a competitive third round, but he did get dropped in that round. Who else has dropped
Luque
him?
Luque hurt him bad.
Vicente Luque dropped him twice. Who else dropped him? He's been dropped in these fights. He got finished on the ground against Nico Price, the back fist. We know this. But for Randy Brown, really nice wins. Finish Brian Barberena. Finish Warley Alves. Finish Alex Oliveira with that one-arm rear naked choke that he had. For Randy Brown, he's known as a boxer, and you can see that fighting out of New York. That really has been a hallmark to his game. Budokan mixed martial arts. He's trained at Killa B. He's trained down in California Kings in the past. He's really brought it together as his career has blossomed. You've really liked to see that out of
he's
him.
He's also going to look three weight classes bigger than poor Massa Randuba.
He gets kicked hot and heavy to his skinny legs, and I say that as a guy who has skinny legs, and Matt, you have skinny legs too. If we got kicked by a guy like, doesn't even have to be Trinaldo.
Alex Oliveira.
I'd be like the guy in UFC 4 that kind of goes down to a knee and blocks it.
I said I'd be like Kevin Ware doing an aggressive closeout to the left corner.
It's not going good. Yeah, but when you look at Randy Brown, what is good? Long range attacks and the power. He's one of those guys. We talk about it. He's got that pop at the end of those long range shots, and he really does pick his shots well. Takedown defense can be to a detriment, but he does have good jiu-jitsu when
good
he is on the mat.
Good offensive wrestling, too.
Good offensive wrestling as well that we don't hear about all that often. So for Trinaldo, I had to switch my mentality. Can he land that big-time jab? It's a powerful jab. Can he switch it up, go into the body, and then back up? Because he's not a giant body kicker, but he will mix in his boxing to the body to try and slow things down as well.
Randy Brown's 15 years younger, and he's going to weigh 30 pounds more.
Like 12 years younger.
It's just a really bad matchup for Trinaldo, and I've been a big fan of this late career resurgence that he's been able to demonstrate. It's just, Randy Brown is on the verge of being a ranked fighter in one of the best divisions in the UFC. I don't think Trinaldo has that in his future, even though, like I said, he's looked really good post 40.
Well, when it comes to the odds, Randy Brown open minus 250 favorite, minus 305 right now. Trinaldo open plus 195. Plus 240. And if you focus in on it for Trinaldo, he's just one of those wily veterans. Like, I bet he goes to the cafe and wears a flat brim UFC cap and everybody knows him by name.
You ever see those, like, you know, there's like police footage or like CCTV of like someone trying to rob a gas station, then like some old guy beats them up and makes them run away? That's gonna be Trinaldo. Like, he just owns some tiny corner store and just be a real hard ass about it until the end of time. Again, no one loves watching Masaran Duba past the age of 40 more than your boy over here. I just think this is a terrible stylistic matchup for him. It really is.
Well, we have a look at the over-under on Tapology. Surprised us as it is to you. Randy Brown's a 3-1 favorite, so I'll say over-under 75% Brown.
I think it'll be in the 90s.
Close. 766 total votes, 89% Brown, 70% by decision, 20% by knockout for the 11% that have Trinaldo, 54% by decision. Matt, this isn't all, because in this co-main event, we threw it out there to you on the YouTube community, in the YouTube community tab, and 75% of you had Randy Brown. Michiganian said, this is Randy's showcase spot here, giving him someone who plots forward and has a granite chin. As long as Randy can stay off the fence, he should win. Akash Deep saying, I think Rude Boy takes it. I like his improvement, should showcase against a tough bet like Trinaldo. Angel or Anhel saying, Trinaldo will never let me down.
When Jeremy Stevens fought Duho Choi, one of the fights on that card was supposed to be Uriah Hall versus Vitor Belfort. Vitor was way past his prime. He was really old, and a lot of people thought that was going to be a great showcase for Uriah Hall and finally get him back up to where people initially thought he would be in the division. This fight reminds me a lot of that fight, honestly. Like, Randy Brown has had a lot of chances against some of the better fighters in the division. Hasn't always won those fights, but he's been able to rebuild himself and keep on looking better after all those losses. Trinaldo still looks like the same fighter he always has been. He just has managed to maintain his youth, if you will, deep into his 40s.
The secret juice.
It must be the secret juice. But yeah, this is a very good fight for Randy Brown to take.
I think Randy Brown's going to get the win. I think it's a long-range attack, so if he can keep his head out of dodge and he doesn't decide to do the Fat Joe lean back like Luke Rockhold, he should be able to get the win here, because Masaran Duba, he keeps his head out, and then he's able to land that left hand, and it catches range. I mean, you look at the reach disparity, you look at the height disparity, the fact that one of these guys is lightweight. I think Randy Brown would have to cut off one of his legs at the knee to make lightweight. Both of us going with Jamaica's Randy Brown to get the win for the Rude Boy. Matt, in the main event coming up this weekend.
Interesting fight.
Mackenzie Dern taking on Yan Xiaonan on Monday night. If you're catching this on Sunday night, late Sunday night, Dana White's Contender Series. It's the last week. Bo Nichols taking on Donovan Beard. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Main event time coming up this weekend. Mackenzie Dern taking on Yan Xiaonan for a battle of strawweight supremacy. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. We've been rocking and rolling with Dana White's Contender Series with Fight Night Picks here for 10 weeks. And depending on the type and the time of week you're watching this, it's over. But if you did check it out, it was a great run. We threw out the subscriber goal for 30,000 subscribers. You guys met that, and we had a great time doing that show. Bo Nickel, Donovan Beard this week, so check it out if you haven't.
I have a pretty good feeling Bo Nickel's going to be in the UFC here pretty soon.
Well, if the fight happened, it happened. Matt Allen, as always, respective socials, at Matt Allen FMP. But to get to the here and now, Mackenzie Dern taking on Yan Xiaonan. It is a funny 5-on-in to watch, because for Yan Xiaonan, she went undefeated in the UFC, took on Carla Esparza as a favorite, lost to the now champion, had to rebuild herself, fights Marina Rodriguez, loses that fight by split decision for Mackenzie Dern. 4-1 is a 5-on-in. She did, of course, lose to Marina Rodriguez as well.
It's gonna happen.
And then she, her last time out, picked up a win by split decision over Tisha Torres. These two are known as specialists. For Mackenzie Dern, it is her grappling. It is her jiu-jitsu. She is a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt. We get that out of the way
one
early.
One of the best ever.
86C success, performance bonuses in the UFC, the whole nine yards. She does get it done that way. But for Yan Xiaonan, it really is her crisp boxing combinations, her entries, her in and out, her ability to cut the cage and utilize her own leg kicks That's what wins her fights. And for Yan Xiaonan, she's one of the more technical strikers that you're going to find in this division.
Without a doubt, she should have a big advantage on the feet in this matchup. But I agree with what you said, but I will give both ladies this credit. Yes, both of them came in as specialists, but I feel like they have done a really good job working at what made them at least human, if you will. Because for Mackenzie Dern, one of the worst strikers we've ever seen when she first came into the UFC. That might be a bit of an exaggeration, but if you can remember all that time ago, and I will say this, it's wild that Mackenzie Dern's still only 29. It feels like she has been around for a very, very long time at this level. But for Dern, in her early UFC tenure, she was getting dropped by Ashley Yoder. Like, she was just rushing in recklessly, throwing Alex Semin punches, like slap punches, and really just being a net negative on the feet. But ever since she has made the adjustment to go train with Jason Perillo at Ruka, she has made quite a few advancements with her striking on the feet. Is she a big kicker? Not at all. Is she the best boxer we've ever seen? No. But when you're a specialist like Mackenzie Dern is to that nth degree with your grappling, you need to fill in the extras at a certain point, and it has been nice to see Dern be able to work on her boxing a lot in her UFC career. And for Yan Xiaonan, it was always the wrestling and the grappling. Ugh, how's it going to look? And granted, against Carla Esparza, it did not look good at all. But that's what Carla does. She's going to go in there, she's going to ground you out, she's going to look great with her own offensive wrestling. But I still feel like Yan Xiaonan, from the first fighter that we saw, has good top pressure. Like, when she's the one who's able to grapple on her own terms, we've seen how damaging her shots can be in that top position. She can threaten with some submissions, although I should not do that in this matchup, no matter what she does. But again, I just feel like both ladies did come in as specialists, but they have been able to round out their game plans to where, okay, if Yan Xiaonan does find herself on the mat against most fighters, I don't think that it's just, oh, she's losing all those exchanges. And the same thing has to be said for Dern. I don't favor her striking against somebody like a Marina Rodriguez or a Wei Li Zhang, but still, she has been able to look a lot better in that one realm of her game to where I don't just think she's going to lose it no matter what. Now, with saying all of that, this fight more than any on the card does seem to be a clash of styles, to where if Mackenzie Dern can even get one takedown, and I'm not stressing, one takedown is all Mackenzie Dern needs against pretty much any fighter in this division to at least threaten with a submission. I don't think she's going to be able to get it every single time, but Dern is so high level with her BJJ that there's not really anybody else in the division that I feel comfortable with grappling with her for any period of time, just because she can be so unorthodox and really threaten with a lot off her back. And I say it especially in this fight because let's say she is on her back. She's not a great offensive wrestler. We have seen that. Her numbers are very poor for her own takedowns. But she does like to get a lot of those, like, trip takedowns, just scrambles, sort of those weird tackle type things.
Bait you into
it. Pull guards, exactly. And from those positions, she is good at getting into the top position from it. Damian Maya liked to do this, where he'd go for that half guard. He'd almost pull guard, get really deep on it, and then try to take your back from that. Mackenzie Dern's going to go for a lot of those types of takedowns in this matchup. And that's why I've always had a hard time putting Dern in sort of the top five of this division. Because again, her one tool is almost as good as anybody's X factor. It's just, are the other parts of her game there enough finally for her to be able to go in there and beat fighters in a five-round atmosphere? Because that's going to be an important thing in this fight.
When you look at it for Mackenzie Dern, she has the five-round experience previously, and you look at her fight against Marina Rodriguez, 49-46 is how you judge that fight. She was able to get it done in, what was it, round number two?
Yeah.
She was able to get that takedown, almost get the finish. It was kind of like Brian Ortega and Alexander Volkanovski. She was able to look really good. But round one...
Jennifer Maya, Valentina.
Pick your fight. Round one... 3, 4, and 5. It was all the Marina Rodriguez striking showing. Dern did show some advancements in her striking, which sort of carried over against Tisha Torres. We're going to talk controversial split decisions. When you look at Mackenzie Dern and Tisha Torres in the moment, I thought Torres won the fight. On the show, UFC 273, we were there for the sidekick. I thought she won. You thought Dern won. It was really close. 11-7, Torres to Dern, 29-28 on MMA decisions. That's how the media scored it. It was very close. Yan Xiaonan versus Marina Rodriguez. 10-10. It was split. 29-28, whether Rodriguez had won or whether Yan Xiaonan had won. But if you look at those matchups, Yan Xiaonan looked really good round one, even though Rodriguez probably won round one. And then I thought Xiaonan did it round two, round three. But it was a nice carryover. No big drop off in the cardio. And she was able to bounce in and out and really dictate a lot of the pressure of that fight against Rodriguez. Whereas Rodriguez against Dern, A lot on the back foot, a little bit on the offensive, but Rodriguez was able to really pull away with a lot of her volume in the strike, and Dern didn't really have a big answer to any of it.
It just feels like when you're fighting Mackenzie Dern, it's like being trapped in quicksand. You have to do everything perfect to be able to get out of those bad situations, and that's the interesting thing about Yan Xiaonan in this matchup. Let's say her takedown defense is similar to what we saw in the Carla Esparza fight. Now, I know Carla is much more of a wrestling-dominant fighter than Mackenzie Dern is, but still, if she looks like that, the window is open for Mackenzie Dern to get a takedown in this matchup. If Dern is able to get on top, again, I could see her losing the first three rounds of this fight, getting top position for 4 minutes in the fourth round, and that being enough for her to be able to get the submissions. Just with Yan Xiaonan, especially on the feet, I think Dern's going to have a really hard time winning a lot of those moments on the in-between. Now, if Dern does just kind of put her head down, try to get into more of those car crash engagements, I think it could help her, because I do favor Yan Xiaonan a lot on the feet with his technique for technique at range. But if Dern can kind of make it a little ugly on the inside, I think that might make Yan Xiaonan at least cognizant of the fact of, okay, we're at close range, I have to worry about the takedown, I gotta worry about the hands a little bit. I think that could help Mackenzie Dern as this fight progresses. I just think on the feet, Yan Xiaonan's a lot more crisp with her own boxing. Now, do you think Yan's going to kick less in this matchup just because of the threat of the takedown from Mackenzie Dern? Because I think that's going to be an important part just to see how is she going to fight this fight.
She's not a huge kicker in her own right. She'll throw them high. She can throw them to the body. She can throw them to the leg. But it very much is boxing combination, 1-2, back out, 1-2-3, end with an uppercut, back out. It really is quick with her footwork, and that's really the thing that adds in. If you look at it, I mean, she's been at Team Alpha Male for quite some time now, so you do expect working with a Darren Elkins, working with some of the fighters that are over there, that you're going to accentuate your takedown defense. For Mackenzie Dern, you look at the level of competition, who she's been training with. You see Sabina Mazel over there and Tabitha Ricci at Ruka Sport, so you get a little bit of a look in the kickboxing from somebody like Mazel. You get a little bit of a look with the takedowns and what you can do with your overall grappling style with Tabitha Ricci. So I would be surprised if Yan Xiaonan does go kick heavy in a matchup like this. But I think in and out, I think when you talk about styles that are conducive to five round fights too, Yan Xiaonan just keeping it on board for five rounds, working the kickboxing, I think it's a style that can win you decisions even in a five round atmosphere. Whereas for Mackenzie Dern, one hit, one kill, jiu-jitsu, I think you can do that in a five-round fight as well. But if you look at the striking, it's not necessarily five-round striking.
It is wild to say that Mackenzie Dern's like Francis Ngannou with her grappling, though. But it is the truth. Like, that's how dangerous of a fighter we're talking about when it comes to Mackenzie Dern and her pure jiu-jitsu. Like, regardless of gender, regardless of weight class, pound for pound, Mackenzie Dern is as good of a grappler in MMA as anybody else in the UFC. You can come at me all you want. That is the absolute truth, though. And that's why I keep on finding myself ever so slightly wanting to favor Mackenzie Dern in this matchup. I just think this could be one of those fights where I'm going to look dumb if she does lose, but I can see her losing round one, losing round two, but just having enough moments in those rounds to help her as the fight continues. I do think that her style of grappling, like we had said, she doesn't need that one big punch to knock you out. It's not that she has to have a crazy amount of cardio in those last two rounds to be able to muster up offense. Her offense just is the grappling portion of her game. And when it comes to grappling cardio, Mackenzie Dern is going to be second to none in that aspect. Again, I just tend to favor Mackenzie Dern for her ability to get those ugly types of takedowns. I know her percentages aren't very good if you look at the pure numbers, but Dern's level of grappling really is second to none. And in a matchup like this where Yan Xiaonan can get caught on her back sometimes, especially if she is having trouble getting back up to her feet, and if you are a fighter who's just kind of waiting for the ref to pick you back up and not being active enough with your own defense, that's where Mackenzie Dern can get one of those crazy slick submissions off when they catch you sleeping. So I think this is a well-contested matchup. I think it's an important fight for the division, because the winner is either finding themselves against like a legend of the sport in like a Jessica Andrade or a Rose Namajunas, or they're finding themselves in like a title eliminator. So I have slightly on Mackenzie Dern, but this should be a fun fight.
Number 5 versus number 6. Mackenzie Dern is the favorite. Open -185, -225 right now. Yan Xiaonan open +160, +185. 76% of you that voted in the YouTube community tab. You can do that every single week. We throw it out there to you. Threw it out here not that long ago. This one has a lot of comments, Matt. Seth MacArthur saying, I get Yan, her takedown defense will be improved. We'll put on a dominant striking display. It's looked really good. The only two fights where it's kind of faltered in the UFC, Claudia Gadelha was able to take her down, but Yan made her pay on the feet. And then the fight against Carla Esparza where it gets finished. Bob, if Dern has not improved her wrestling, I don't know what to say.
And then this thing about Dern, like, her jujitsu is so good, but her wrestling isn't. So she does really lack that one transition to be able to take it from the feet to her grappling.
Chad, the UFC dad, I feel like UFC is giving Dern a layup. She's talented and marketable. Everything the UFC drools over. Dern by sub. Angelo threw out a sleeping emoji. Philip Martin said these fight nights with mains, these mains need to stop. It's awful. And we got one pick for Yan Xiaonan. So Matt, you like the grappling of Mackenzie Dern. I agree with you. I think when you look at Dern and her style, she just needs that one takedown to get a finish in a matchup like this. Yan Xiaonan's a striker. You're out of water regardless when you take it to the mat, no matter how much you work your takedown defense. But likewise, Mackenzie Dern's not a striker. Yan Xiaonan's a lifelong striker with her boxing. And I think for Yan Xiaonan, she has that five-round ability or capability. We haven't seen it in the UFC yet. But just with the style that she has, I absolutely love her boxing combinations, her in-and-out movement, side-to-side, and obviously in-and-out, as I said. So I like Yan Xiaonan in this matchup. I think an opportunity as an underdog here where the line's going to continue to grow. People might point to the fact that maybe age-wise, she's a little bit over the hill because 31, 32, you're in your prime. She just turned 33. But I do like Yan Xiaonan with her striking. I think she's that much better of a striker. And Mackenzie Dern with her takedowns, they might be unorthodox, but they're not high percentage looks. Not like Carla Esparza. Not like Claudia Gadelha, where they're going to go in and just push the pace and try and wrestle and grapple you down. I think Xiaonan can get the win. But again, I can see Dern winning this fight. You can see a way where Xiaonan can.
Oh, the much steadier fighter is Yan Xiaonan. Again, I just like the higher highs in the grappling of Mackenzie Dern in this matchup. When you have a specialist of her level, if you even get the fight on your terms for 5 seconds, it is a massive advantage. So I like Dern for those reasons.
Big opportunity for both of these fighters. Matt going with Mackenzie Dern to get the win. I'm going to be going with Yan Xiaonan. You let us know throughout the week in the comments. That's how you help out the channel.
Exactly.
You hit the comment section. You can hit the tip button on here. You can super chat
us. Retweet.
Question Mark Kick starts on Saturday. It's 2 hours before the prelims. You have this fight night card, and then there's another week break, and then you have another fight night card, and that's Alexa Grasso and Viviani Araujo.
Back like we never left.
And UFC 280 is coming up after that, and that's good. And then after that, you have another big fight night card. So Dana White's Contender Series is coming to an end this week. We have our video Monday night. It's live. Help that up. And then it's we're just kind of lost in the ethos of MMA for a little bit.
We are, but I am excited for this card. Initially, when I came here to break this down, I wasn't all that excited, but we've gone through a lot of really fun fights. Alexei Olenek, Khalil Latifi is a weird one that's buried on the prelims. I know Brennan Allen, Christoph Jocko is one that we're both excited for. Not middleweights that you think, hey, they're going to challenge for the title tomorrow, but that's going to be a good quality win for either guy.
Mike D. Yavis taking on Slava Borshev. That's a really good fight as well. So some great fights coming up this week. Bake that algorithm, the likes, the comments. It does help us out. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.